Live from Monster Dome, deep underneath and yet somehow still five stories above Austin, Texas, this is Inside the Locker, the geekiest sportscast you've ever heard.
Shove aside the gym socks, the cricket bats, and the still-in-the-box Iron Man action figures. You have just stepped inside the locker. This is the weekly nerdy sportscast that doesn't draw a line of distinction between carbon scoring and scoring on a balk in baseball. Both are nasty, both irritating, and really upset the droids. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, acquitted. I am joined by the man who knew too much, JC DeLeon.
What's up?
The demolition man, Elliot Fontanette.
Nice to see y'all again.
And the third man, even though I've introduced him fourth, Adam Beef Nuggets Charles.
Oh, Jesus Christ, let him have a kazoo.
Who is the kazoo? Who has a kazoo, apparently. So that's new and exciting.
By the way, hi.
Hello, Adam. It's nice to hear you.
So when does this show get the cute kid to up the ratings?
The Cousin Oliver?
Yeah, are we there yet?
No, I don't think that we are. I don't think that we ever will be, thankfully.
Okay. Do any of us know any cute kids even to bring on the show anyway?
Not that I can go within 500 yards of legally, so we'll just kind of leave that on the back burner. But I want to remind you guys that Inside the Locker, just like all of our content here at One of Us, is available on iTunes. Just search One of Us in the podcast section. You can also find us on Stitcher by doing the same damn thing. You can follow this show on Twitter at ITLcast, or you can follow the website at One of Us Net. You can also like the website on Facebook, facebook.com/One of Us Net. And I do want to encourage you guys, you might have noticed that every post for the last week or so has had underneath the footer a little GoFundMe image. We're trying to raise money for a fan of ours out in Georgia who's fallen on some hard times and is really struggling, and we're just trying to help him get back on his feet. His name's Eli. So if you have a few extra shekels to throw Eli's way, I know he and we would definitely appreciate that. So just look for the GoFundMe link right here on the page, right at the bottom of the post. That we would really appreciate that. And don't forget to become a subscriber to One of Us Net. You'll see a little button there to the right on the sidebar that'll take you to and explain all of the various levels of subscription, from a red shirt all the way up to a Jedi, with the various perks and benefits of each one. And also want to remind you that coming up here next weekend, that is the 15th through the 17th, will be the first ever Yule Fest of Us. Yes, that's right. All the hard work and all the donations that you put in during Podathon are coming to fruition. We have a full lineup of events. The Facebook event page just went up and explains everything we're doing.
I think the website is broken, Brian.
It may have. I think my brain is now officially...
And his stints on Rage Select, I think he has been overloaded. And what we need to do is we need to take him back to a room with just a CRT television.
Sure.
And a VCR.
Yes.
And like 100 this. Copies of Kick Puncher.
I like all of these ideas.
And just reset him.
I am on board for every single one of those ideas, Elliot. You think that I'm kidding. I'm not kidding.
Did you say 100 copies of Kick Puncher?
Yes.
He can watch the same one over and over again.
Yeah, I can. I can, actually.
Well, it's a punch with the power of kicks.
Yes, but I think his point is that it's hard to watch multiple VHS tapes at the same time.
Well, we know, Brian, he's going to wear out one very fast.
Well, it's like in Friends when Joey thinks he's rented Die Hard 2, but he just rented Die Hard again.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you watch Die Hard again, and it's Die Hard 2.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, absolutely. So, in our main segment today, we are going to stack up this summer season against the summer movie seasons of the last 6 years. But first, hold the goddamn phone. It's sports news.
Flash to Captain and Mrs. America and all the ships at SeaQuest. These are the scores and stories.
Stop the press.
And sad, sad, awful, horrible news to start on this week. Here at Inside the Locker, we pride ourselves on bringing you the most important sports headlines as they happen. But then we also pride ourselves on being able to fly and sleeping with a rotating harem that includes Jessica Alba, Christina Hendricks, and every last Laker girl.
Thank you.
The reality is, news tends to break while we are editing the previous week's episode, and so the only way the news we report would be news to you is if you happen to be Leonard from Memento. So we do apologize that this stuff keeps happening the day after we record the episode. I don't know why. I don't know which of the olden gods we pissed off, but that's just the way it keeps happening. But you may have noticed that playing USA basketball, Pacers forward Paul George went Joe Theismann on his own leg. I don't know if you guys have watched the video. It's pretty gruesome. He suffered I believe it was a compound fracture of his left leg.
Yeah.
And Yeah, it's pretty gruesome.
Shin snapped right in half. Oh.
Like balsa wood.
Yeah, I saw on Twitter people talking about the injury, and people saying it looked bad, and I thought maybe his knee pulled up, kind of the way Derek Rose did when he hurt his knee. And so I didn't think it was what it was. And then I watched the... not just a video, but a vine. You know how vines, like, repeat themselves?
Somebody made a vine of his leg snapping?
That snap, though.
Yeah, that snap, though. Yeah,
talk about a Snapchat.
And so, yeah, I saw him go up, and I saw him go down, and it was kind of like I was watching in slow motion because I was like, oh, wait, I know it's about to end.
There's no stopping that.
I feel like I was watching JFK, and Kevin Costner was going to come on the screen and say, back to the left.
Back and to the left.
Yeah.
So, of course, the big question now is, what does this mean for the Indiana Pacers? And I think the simple answer is that they are fucked completely. You may remember that I don't want to say we lost Lance Stephenson, because you tend to lose things that you want to keep. And we more or less got rid of Lance Stephenson, sent him packing to the Hornets. It's like as much as Lance Stephen was locker room cancer and was kind of... a buffoon on the court. It sucks that we don't have him now.
It's like, I got rid of the herpes.
Yeah, it's like if you have Terrell Owens and you have Dez Bryant, which the Cowboys did, and they decide, oh, I'm going to keep Dez Bryant and get rid of the locker room cancer that is Terrell Owens. But if Dez Bryant were to get injured, it's like, well, maybe he's not such a bad guy. Yeah, no, he is totally.
Which did happen, by the way.
It did. It did actually happen. So that was that was a good analogy.
That was
a very
good analogy.
I thought I was making it up.
There are a couple things that routes the Pacers could go. They could go the route of the San Antonio Spurs when David Robinson had his major injury and they just kind of tanked the season, and Tim Duncan just kind of fell into their lap, and a dynasty later. Greatest power forward of all time.
Yeah.
That worked out pretty well for the Spurs, despite that one really bad year, which the Pacers are about to have.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate, because with LeBron leaving Miami, I felt like this was a good year. Like, as strong as... I mean, LeBron is still in the Eastern Conference. He's still going to be an obstacle, but I felt like we were poised, with the Miami Big Three breaking up, to be in a position to make that run to the championship this time, and those hopes have been summarily dashed. Like, seriously, like an old Sumerian curse. Like, I'm pretty sure that there's some old lady reading cuneiform and cursing Paul George as he's playing. Now, of course, the other debate this has raised is the merits of USA basketball. Is it really worthwhile? I mean, these guys, doesn't really do anything for them and their team to go play USA basketball, and yet they're putting their bodies at risk the entire time. So what do you guys think? Do you think this is another sort of strike against the validity of USA basketball?
Yes. Well, when this whole thing started, like, basically GMs and owners kind of imagined the worst case scenario, and this is pretty much the exact worst case scenario, but it's taken 20 years for this worst case scenario to happen. I think players get a lot of players get a sense of pride playing for the US. Maybe not so much for the FIBA World Cup, but like for the Olympics they definitely do. Plus, owner, coaches, and GMs love it when their players come back better, having benefited from that time of, playing competitively in the summer.
Yeah, and the other argument I heard, which I thought was really interesting, is that it's not like these guys stop playing basketball in the off season.
Exactly,
they apparently play all the time. There's practices, and there are myriad situations where these freak accidents could occur.
Yeah.
So, with that in mind, it's like, well, at least this way, it's as if they were practicing, but there was some, purpose behind it. They're representing Team USA, and of course the dream team will always be the paradigm there. But I don't know. Like, I think it's harder for me to be objective about this, considering it's my team that just suffered like a horrendous setback because of Team USA basketball.
It's like they were playing Monopoly, and got the bad community chest. Like, oh, you're going to go to jail for a year.
Yeah, and
that's just the shit that happens. You don't own these players; you just pay them.
And the Pacers had bad luck already. I mean, they were forced to be the wheelbarrow. Nobody wants to be the fucking wheelbarrow. Yeah. That's the problem.
What I think the other facet of this is that it's not necessary. I mean, it's patriotism from the perspective of the players, because that's the reason why they play. They don't get paid for it,
right? Exactly.
And there's no compensation for the owners for allowing their players to go play in there. Like, there is a body that gets paid from this, and they get paid a lot of money. So, I guess it's hard to say that you should. That it's not negative that they play, but I can't see the positive. If the positive is really just patriotism for your country, then nobody should be making money off of this,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah, FIBA is just as corrupt an organization as FIFA. So
yeah, that's you see, but and there it is. There's the other wrinkle here is it's like you take all this away, the people putting themselves at risk on bodies that are already banged up from a taxing game like basketball. The only people making money off this is FIBA.
Yeah, the only thing that's weird about
it... Like Paul George snapped his FIBA. Yeah, no, exactly.
Yeah, the only thing that's weird about it is the timing of it. Like, a couple days before this, the NBA was reprimanding players for playing in unsanctioned tournaments in the Philippines, which, I mean, doesn't sound like a good idea to begin with. But
you shouldn't be doing anything unsanctioned in the Philippines. Because it's the Philippines, and they will sanction a lot of shit. Like, we've all seen Hangover 2. There's a lot of things that are completely sanctioned in the Philippines that would not fly in any other country.
I thought that was Thailand. Yeah,
and their senators are world champions. Like, they're like world champion
boxers. Oh, you're right, you're right.
Like, I'm not going
to
be a...
No, you're right, no, you're right.
But it was just weird because it made me think back to those times as a kid where I would do something that I wasn't supposed to, and I would have done it 100 times, and the one time my mom catches me, tells me not to do it again... And then I do it again, and then I break my leg.
But here's the thing, you know.
That was a really specific analogy. Well, so what happened?
Were you not telling us? Is that what?
No, I didn't break my leg.
So it's all Paul George's mom's fault.
Yeah, I think that's what we're getting.
I didn't break my leg. I broke my wrist. Like it was a park that had a low basket that I was low enough for me to dunk on. And my mom one day saw me like dunking on it, and hanging on the rim, and she said, "Don't do that because you're gonna fall." And hurt yourself one day, and then like the next day I fell and I broke my wrist.
You had that Christmas story second where you're like, holy damn it, I actually shot my eye out.
Yeah, no, my brother had a situation like that. I remember we were at some roller skating party for his birthday. I think he was like 6 or 7, and I was like, Blake, we gotta go. Mom and Dad say we gotta go. He's like, no, I'm going around one more time. I was like, Blake, we gotta go. No, one more time. I was like, fine, go around one more time. And he got about 3 feet from the exit on that last lap and fell and broke his arm. And I don't like to say I told you so, but this is several years later, and I'm still doing it. So like clearly I lied about that first thing I said.
And obviously both of you guys cost Indiana Pacers like millions of dollars.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
And then, you know, you say unsanctioned, but I mean, what the GMs and they need to start doing then is they need to start saying, oh, your off season, you will come practice in our facilities. You're not allowed to do any of this. They need to build that into the contract because you can't have ambiguity there.
That's what the NFL does,
Yeah. It's like, you can't, I mean, people, I mean, just the amount of attention that's paid to the off-season conditioning of players is strange to me. It's like, I just really started following it. Like, people are looking at LeBron because he apparently cut carbs and dropped about 10 pounds.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, maybe he just... wanted to lose a little weight because maybe he was getting too bulky.
See, but the thing is, he's actually recently
he does have cramping problems.
Yeah,
I mean, he could go to lose maybe a pound or two.
And that's the thing we're going to talk about the San Antonio Spurs in this show. But that's like the only thing that I hold against San Antonio Spurs fans because it pissed me off to no end that they were like making fun of him for having cramps in a hundred degree stadium. It's like, you know what? I don't see your ass out there. Go fuck yourself.
Yeah. The type of cramps that he had were the type of cramps that I felt in one of my years doing 2 days in football. And it's all the years playing football, I've had concussions, I've broken bones. The most pain that I've ever been in, maybe in my life, were the times that my legs completely seized up and I could do nothing with them.
And that's not really a pain thing. It's just like literally you can't move your legs.
Yeah.
It's not like he can't. It's not like he can't. Like, he can play if his legs would just allow him to move.
And I say this as an overweight man. I was just in San Antonio, and I can speak to the general fitness of the people in that city.
Mm-hmm.
They have exactly no room to talk about physical fitness. I'm just saying.
Yeah. They also don't have a lot of room when they go through doorways.
Yeah. A lot of good Mexican food.
Yeah.
A shit ton of good Mexican food. A great Riverwalk. A great city, but... Yeah. Don't say shit unless you want to get right back at you.
Yeah. I remember one of the funniest exchanges when that happened on Twitter was between Richard Sherman and Sidney Rice, where Richard Sherman was kind of clowning LeBron for the cramping thing, and Sidney Rice is like, man, I remember when you had those your rookie year, and you told me to call the police.
What did Sherman say in response?
Yeah, you know, that's actually a good point, because when you start having those cramps, you will, like, just say... Because it feels like your muscle is somehow going to form into a T-1000 steel dagger and poke through your skin. Like, there is no... I don't know the medical reason for it. I'm not a doctor. I don't know if you guys have been confusing me with one all this time, but it turns out I'm not. But I will say this about LeBron. He has slimmed down a lot. In fact, he lost several hundred pounds of dead weight when he left Chris Bosh.
So. one deserves funny. A clap right there.
It's funny because it's entirely true.
Well, that's the funny thing. Bosch is now going to be the centerpiece of Miami, and it's like, have y'all watched the last 4 years?
Yeah, he can be the centerpiece of Jurassic Park 2. because that one did have some great Raptor moments, but that's about it, really. Anyway, moving on from Paul George, it's a very sad story. It makes me very unhappy. Another athlete who has been plagued by injuries and has not only facing a career-ending injury, but his career has ended because of injury, is David Wilson. If you're not familiar with David Wilson, he is a running back for the New York Giants. He was their first-round pick in 2012. He has played off and on over the last two seasons due to neck injuries. And over those two seasons, I just want to run down some stats here. He's had seven touchdowns, five rushing touchdowns, one receiving touchdown, and one kickoff return for a touchdown. And chronic neck injury and concerns that those injuries could end up killing him have officially forced him out of the league, which is really, really upsetting. But the reason this is in the news right now is because he just made an address to the media, sort of farewell speech. And, you know, I watched it, and I got to say, he gave one of the most passionate and gracious speeches I've ever heard an athlete give. I mean, he's emphasized over and over again that he was not pitying himself, he was not sad, that he was grateful to the NFL, to the New York Giants, for allowing, you know, a kid to achieve his dream of playing in the NFL, and that he has absolutely no regrets, and that, I mean, it was just beautiful. Like, and he gets very emotional, and he says to the crowd, like, listen, I want you guys to understand these are tears of joy. Like, I'm not pitying myself. I know that I've been very fortunate and that I've gotten to achieve a dream that most people don't, and I'll be thankful every day for that. And it wasn't quite, I love Brian Piccolo, and if you, you know, hit your knees tonight, tell God to love him too. But it was close. It was close.
It showed that, you know, so often in our society, especially in sports, you see people with a sense of entitlement.
Yeah.
And a sense of, you know, not really appreciating all that you do have.
Right.
It's like, this guy got to play a game he loved, probably made millions of dollars, probably still has that in the bank, is going to have, like, probably a really good pension. There's probably something with the players union that'll cover him. And
one would hope.
And he's probably going to end up on, like, either a local sports broadcast or maybe even national after this performance. I mean, so he's set up pretty good, and it's good that he recognizes that and appreciates that. I mean, it's a shitty situation. But he got to do what he loves, and I mean, even though he has a neck injury, he's gonna know. I'm trying to look on the bright side. I'm not trying to be shitty. He's not gonna have like a horrible brain injury 20 years from now.
That's true too.
He mentioned like being grateful enough to literally walk away from the game.
Right. Yes, that's entirely true, and that's
just walk away.
That's something where, you know, that's we're dealing with a lot in the NFL right now is, you know, these players once they retire, you know, 50, 60 year old guys being completely almost brain dead. Or having, you know, such a loss of mental faculties that they end up hurting themselves, or it's just it's sad. It really
or their
is,
family,
or their families. It's a really sad situation. But I got to say, the person we should or we should really be saddest here for the New York Giants, because I really think this guy had amazing potential, and he looked as though he was going to be their superstar. And now they've got nothing. They've got no depth at all at running back. And you have to remember, they lost Ahmad Bradshaw to the Colts. They lost, Brandon Jacobs.
Yeah.
So they have nothing without David Wilson. And it's, I think, you know, as gracious as he was, it just, the more gracious he was, the more I realized how much the Giants really are losing without him. And it's, you know, it's really sad. I mean, it's like a movie that ends too soon, or in this case, a movie that doesn't get to be made at all. I mean, right when it shows all the potential, we never get to see that potential come to fruition. I mean, this is the Jodorowsky's Dune of football news. I mean, we look at David Wilson and we wonder what may have been, and we all missed out on seeing something spectacular watching him play, and we will never get to see it again. And I think that's my buddy Rod has this book about a lot of, you know, there's a history, and it's something that really fascinates me, of the movies that never were, of the films that never got made. I mean, Hitchcock alone has like four or five of them. It's crazy. And one of the ones by Hitchcock was going to be a thriller with Audrey Hepburn.
Ooh.
And I was really looking, like, I was reading, I was like, man, I would love to see this. But even like Steven Spielberg had one that was going to be like a really crazy scary alien abduction movie. Not like Close Encounters, where it ends up being really heartwarming, but like a seriously scary...
And not like Fire in the Sky, which ends up being shitty.
Yeah, exactly. And that movie never got to be made either, so it's just, you know, it's crazy. There was a Marilyn Monroe movie that she was going to do with Dean Martin. You know, there's all kinds of great films that never were because of one reason or another. So.
I remember Kubrick had, too. Kubrick had, he had the Aryan Papers, which he decided not to make whenever Spielberg was doing Schindler's List,
because
he thought that they were too close in content, so he probably wouldn't get made. And then he was trying to get a Napoleon movie off the ground, I think, sometime back in the 60s.
Yeah.
And because of the failure of Waterloo at the box office, like, he couldn't get anybody to finance
it. Waterloo had its own Waterloo.
Yeah. It was literally his Waterloo.
It was literally his Waterloo.
I mean, and there was, you know, Michael Bay not getting to take over Star Wars. I'm just fucking
I was going to say, yeah.
That's a good thing.
Let's sit around and ponder what may have been with that, hey, I'm sure.
Keep in mind that before Star Wars got launched, Michael Bay still could produce fun movies.
He could.
The Rock.
You said it entirely. He could produce fun movies.
Yeah,
produce. I still think he can produce. Well, no, never mind.
I don't know.
I saw Ninja Turtles. No, he can't.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm looking forward to that
one. Oh, Elliot, you
poor, I'm going to go see it for $5 at the first showing.
You have to see it for yourself. You can't base your entire opinion on what somebody else says, but I will tell you, you're going to hate it.
No, I didn't listen to the review, but I read the comments, and apparently you were pissed.
I got a little
verklempt?
No, a little peeved. At Michael Bay and at Jonathan... Yes, I know, Michael Bay didn't direct it. I'm as tired of people saying, you know, critics, Michael Bay didn't direct the movie, as I am with people saying that Michael Bay directed the movie.
He did direct Transformers 4.
Yes, he did direct Transformers 4.
And that was a shit.
And I'm sorry, if you watch Ninja Turtles and don't believe there's a Spielberg, Toby Hooper, Poltergeist situation going on here, you're blind. Because that movie, like, there's so much of that movie that's just Michael Bay.
Well, that's the thing. Even if you have somebody else direct it, I mean, if his name was on it, you're going to expect a certain type of... Yeah. Look to it.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Still, his best film that he's made in the 2000s was 2005's Island. Like,
I don't know. I think I like Pain and Gain more than The Island.
Bad I always Boys forget 2. About Pain and Gain.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, my God. Bad Boys 2. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Bad Boys 2 is...
He doesn't
is,
like Bad Boys 2.
Bad Boys 2 is awesome!
It's an atrocious film. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. There's literally a point where they run out of stuff to destroy. So in the script, it's like, I don't know, what do we throw dead bodies at him? That would be stupid. No, do that! Yes. Do that! That sounds awesome!
But doesn't it?
Yeah!
No, it doesn't!
They throw a boat out of
I mean, come on, if you're reading the script, you're like, oh wow, why didn't I think
Michael
that?
Bay is an overpaid child who literally makes bank dumping his toy box out on a highway and going, that's his entire career.
Michael Bay is now Jack Black.
Yeah, pretty much. He's the Jack Black of destruction. I thought it was Jack Black, but no, apparently it's Michael Bay. Moving on, Andy Dalton is about to be Oprah rich!
Maybe.
Yeah. Dot. Maybe. So the Cincinnati Bengals quarterback got a Tony Stark-like payday when the team signed him to a 6-year, $115 million contract. This contract comes in clear defiance of the incontrovertible fact that he is indeed Andy Dalton.
Yeah.
They gave, I'm going to repeat this, Andy Dalton a 6-year, $115 million contract. Folks, Andy Dalton's not a terrible quarterback. He's just not a quarterback that's worth $115 million. Man. This, to me, is another Joe Flacco fiasco. A flacasco. Is that a thing? Can we say that? I think we can say that.
He's not a flacasco. He's not a bad quarterback, but he's like the grocery store brand quarterback.
That was Kurt Warner. You literally just described Kurt Warner was working at a grocery store before the Super Bowl that he won. He is the grocery store quarterback.
There are almost no times where you can say the Bengals win their game because of Andy Dalton, but there are a few times in which you could say they lost the game because of Andy Dalton.
Yeah, most of the time it's they won despite Andy Dalton.
Yeah, I mean, he's coming off a year in which he had career highs in both touchdowns and interceptions at the same time.
Yeah. And the type of weapon that he has in A.J. Green, like, he should be putting up much better numbers than he does.
Yeah. And you know, they've got a great running game. They've got great defense. There's a lot of weapons on that team. But here's the thing. As JC will explain, it sounds like a big number, but they're also kind of fucking him at the same time.
Yeah, it's NFL contracts are weird in the way they work out, and it's kind of one of the problems I have with NFL contracts, considering how dangerous the sport it is. He's going to make $22 million of that $115 in the first 6 months of the deal. Almost everything after that, after the first 2 years, is almost year to year. And it's the Bengals can, at any point, just say he's not living up to the terms of his contract, and he has no recourse. So, you know, it's not exactly $115 guaranteed, but...
So what are the stipulations?
Those type of stipulations are never made public. It's just the terms as far as how many years are guaranteed is the only thing, are the only things that are ever made public.
Well, I tell you what it reminds me of is it reminds me of it reminds me of when Hollywood throws too much money where it isn't deserved, and by that I mean paying an actor an exorbitant amount of money to be in one movie. Now, I'm not going to throw out like how much Tom Hanks made for Forrest Gump because that's a great movie. I'm not going to throw out, you know, how much Tom Cruise made over the franchise of the Mission Impossible films because three out of four of those are good. What I will point out, though, is that Harrison Ford got paid $65 million for Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Tom Cruise got $100 million for War of the Worlds.
Oof. Wasn't bad.
And of course, Marlon Brando's infamous $3.7 million payday for 13 days of work on Superman in 1978. Now, adjusted for inflation, that's $14 million for 13 days of work. Meaning, he got paid, when you adjust it for inflation, more than $1 million a day.
Mm-hmm.
That is insane.
Damn.
And at the time, people were like, why the hell would you do that? And
it was by the pound. I mean, he's... He was a good 400 plus by that point.
And to be fair, they were still reusing his voiceover in 2006.
Oh yeah, they totally got their money's worth there.
Yeah. I'm just saying, like, it is iconic. Like, that speech is something that still gives me chills.
Oh, and we get to use your voice after you're dead. Well, in that case, probably would have done it anyway.
Yeah, but the only impact this type of contract
is it a deep
have,
impact.
Yeah,
it's more like Armageddon.
Is guys like Russell Wilson, Cam Newton, and even Alex Smith are just smiling ear to ear because their payday is coming.
Yeah,
Russell Wilson's better be on the way.
Russell Wilson should be the one getting the 6-year, $150 million contract. I mean, we all, like Bengals. We kind of made the playoffs versus Russell Williams. I'm basically a rookie and I've won the Super Bowl. So money, please.
But the paradox for him is that one of the reasons he won is that he was paid so little that they could get all these great players.
That's true. That's a valid argument. Absolutely. We'll have to see what happens with Brando Dalton in the future. But for now, apparently the Cavs have finalized the trade for Kevin Love unofficially.
Yeah, because
agreement in principle.
Well, yeah, because they officially signed Andrew Wiggins a few days ago, and he, by league rules, can't be traded for 30 days.
Okay.
So, it's probably a good thing that Kevin Love pulled out of the USA basketball, because if he were to Paul George himself at any
point. Oh, Jesus Christ, he's a verb now.
Oh, he's already a verb.
Oh, man. If anything like that were to happen, Cleveland could be like, no, you keep him.
Yeah, I mean, damn.
I want to know why no one in Cleveland said that when LeBron came back to Miami. Just, no, you keep him, that's fine.
Because people are hypocrites.
Yes, they are. And that all the people in Cleveland are just battered wives. Oh, there's still some good in him. He won't hit me again. All right, Tina.
Yeah.
But, well, yeah, you know what? This is becoming, like, the unofficial part is kind of like how Khan is unofficially reported to be the villain for Star Trek Into Darkness. It's like, no, it's not true. It's just unofficial.
Yeah, nearly every aspect of this trade is kind of a promise. Like, you know, we all know LeBron signed a 2-year deal with he can opt out after next season.
Wait, a 2-year deal with who?
With Cleveland.
Wait, he's going back to Cleveland? Why didn't I hear about this for 6 straight weeks?
And he could opt out after the season if he wanted to. Kevin Love has promised that he'll opt out of his contract at the end of this season and re-up with a longer deal with Cavaliers, kind of like LeBron has promised too. And it's like, nobody's really held to anything other than...
Well, isn't the thing the way they want to structure the deals for, like, I guess, cash flow for to get other people?
Money there, cash flow.
There is that. I mean, the large school of thought, specifically to LeBron's deal, is he's kind of holding the fire to Dan Gilbert, and he's like, give me what I want, or I will opt out again. I will rip this city's heart out again if you don't give me what I want.
Leverage is a thing. I mean, that's a good... I mean, especially when you got a guy who types in Comic Sans to type a horrible letter.
Yeah.
When Cleveland is ashes, you have my permission to sign me.
I don't know. I see them, like, with Kiri and Kevin Love.
You think Amnesty is your ally? Go ahead.
we have Bo as Bane right now. I'm sorry, Adam is.
I'm jerking off. This is what it sounds like when Bane jerks off.
That's a really weird Prince song.
Sorry, what were you saying? We were making valid points and actually having a discussion, and then we did something silly.
I think I could add them off.
No, you didn't, actually. I was just laughing. Keep talking.
No, I think with Curry and Kevin Love and LeBron, I think they're going to win the East this year. I mean,
with Paul George being out.
I think the only team that can stand against them, if Derrick Rose is really healthy, the Bulls are going to be fucking
If Derrick Rose is healthy, and with the addition of Paul Gasol, that's going to be the team to beat in the East, I think.
But, yeah,
I think you're right. I think if Derrick Rose is, you know, if his knees prove to be as balsa woody as they have in years past.
If he's Mr. Glass.
If he's Mr. Glass. They call me Derrick Rose! If that happens, then, yeah, Cleveland is already positioning itself to be, and I'll say this, I'll go on the record and say this, if LeBron wins a championship this year with Cleveland, I will be there cheering him on. Because, not for LeBron, but for Cleveland. Because Cleveland fucking deserves it. Well, they don't deserve it. They need one. You know what? Never mind. Fuck them. I said that, and then I remembered them burning his jersey in a parking lot.
Right.
And,
exactly. What exactly do they need / deserve at this point?
He's the hero they want, but not necessarily the one they deserve right now.
There you go. Yeah. Honestly, to me, the whole LeBron leaving and coming back feels like he just listened to the Puffy song coming home. And when he left, it was like, I want to make this appropriate. Because that song is so, just on point for his comeback. You're going to hear it every goddamn game in Cleveland next year.
Yeah. Yeah, more than likely. But hey, here's another story that's kind of based around LeBron because, you know, apparently we're ESPN now. ESPN has suspended Dan Lebatard for being a trolling Lebatard. Yeah. So good job, Dan. That's awesome.
He paid for... it's funny, but I listen to the Dan Lebatard show every day.
Oh, you're the one.
He paid for billboards to go up in Akron that say, in Comic Sans, you're welcome, LeBron, and there's a picture of two championship rings, and it says, love, Miami.
See, it's not that he's a troll. It's not that he's tearing up, you know, wounds that are freshly healed over for the city of Akron. My big problem with this motherfucker is he used Comic Sans. Yeah. Who does that?
Well, Dan Gilbert. Dan Gilbert.
Just evil people. Just evil people.
Every time you use Comic Sans, a graphic designer cries.
Thank you.
Well, that's why he did it, because Dan Gilbert used it. This is kind of one of those times where this is me, a LeBron fan, saying that the way ESPN kind of leaps to the defense of LeBron James is...
Wait, I'm sorry. Did we mention the fact that he's been suspended for 2 days from the airwaves because of this billboard?
Yeah.
Why would you suspend it?
ESPN's official statement was that his stunt that he didn't alert them about is not representative of ESPN's brand.
Which is to say it's not representative of their LeBron brand.
Yeah, but here's the thing about that. Like I said, I listen to the Lebatard show every day. He's been planning this for 10 days. He's been talking about it on the air for 10 days.
That's what you call... I have a word for this, and then I have a translation.
Yeah.
This is called plausible deniability or having your cake and eating it, too.
I think this is a situation, and I really do believe this, where ESPN's gotten to the point where one hand doesn't know what the rest of Bristol, Connecticut is doing.
Yeah.
That's the problem. They literally don't watch their own fucking shows. They put on so many trash... programs at this point, so many trash TV shows that all basically cover the same stuff that they're not even watching anymore.
Yeah, they let him broadcast his show. He lives in Miami. The show is broadcast from Miami. This ESPN just lets the signal go nationally. Yeah.
Well, I mean, what I don't know is why you're so shocked that a shock jock, to a certain degree, is doing doing shocking things.
No. The problem is that if it were any other athlete that he was trolling, ESPN would not give two shits. Mm-hmm. I'm against what he did because I think that even though, these shows are dependent upon personalities and everyone can be a fan, I do think you have to hold on to at least a shred of objectivity to be a sports journalist. And I realize this is ironic coming from me and how much I hate LeBron, but you'll also remember that I'm the one that said I would kind of be cheering him on if he wins a championship with Cleveland.
Yeah. Then you retracted that.
And then I retracted that. Don't worry about it. The point being, I'm not paid by ESPN. The point being that's why I should be upset. That's why ESPN should be upset, is because he is demonstrating a complete and utter lack of objectivity. But why they're really upset, and this is very Fox News, is because he's going after LeBron, who is he's throwing eggs at the golden goose, and that's what they're pissed off about.
And here's the thing. I mean, it depends on whether you think of ESPN as a news organization or as an entertainment organization.
Yeah.
Because if they're entertainment – it's in their best interest not to piss off the NFL, the NBA, the best player in the NBA, and just because you get that access.
Yeah.
Because that's how ESPN beats you.
But well, then they shouldn't get that. I'm sorry. If they want to label themselves as an entertainment network and that's why they're going to excuse themselves from things like this, they should not be the ones breaking all the news. They should not be the network that everybody goes to break news.
No. Brian, I promise you I'm not trying to be sarcastic, but in all seriousness, that's modern news these days. Yeah. That's just what it is.
It's just crazy.
It doesn't mean I have to like it, man.
I'm not saying you have to like it.
Yeah.
The guy in network was right, but that's where we are.
It's just crazy because, like, out of all the things that Levitard does, like, this billboard stunt is really his most tame. Like, one of the things that he does a lot that irritates me is he'll trap people into weird race discussions. He'll be like, all right, let's take Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, and Drew Brees, and let's look at Cam Newton, RG3, and Michael Vick. And what's the difference between those quarterbacks?
Stats.
Well, no, eventually the room will go quiet, and somebody will go, three black and three are white. He goes, I didn't say that. That's not what I said.
Oh, hey, Glenn Betts.
That's what you said.
Yeah.
I'm just asking questions.
Like I said, man.
He's like, those are pocket quarterbacks versus running quarterbacks.
ESPN is very much like Fox News in that they decide who they're going to hitch their wagon to, and then they are completely subjective, and they are completely fawning over those. Let me ask you this question. Would he have gotten a two-day suspension if he was trolling DeAndre Jordan, Tyler Zeller, or Channing Frye? Nobody would give a shit.
Yeah. He's like, I don't think it would have made the news.
No. Yeah. No. And for ESPN to like, and first of all, a two-day suspension from the air? Really? Like, if that's not the weakest slap on the wrist I've ever heard of,
yeah.
It serves only to remind us that ESPN, like, their brand, and I love that that's what they said, because it doesn't represent our brand. The brand they're specifically talking about is LeBron James.
And the thing is, there's a balance you can strike between trolling and then, like, being mean with, like, I think it was Gatorade when LeBron had his, like, cramps. Like, well, he's not drinking Oxy because he endorsed Powerade, but he actually was drinking Gatorade the entire time. You were just being a dick.
And
you don't have to kiss their boots, but you also want to be mean. Just let him do this. Nobody would have fucking noticed, and it would have been down.
I feel like with this stunt, he was doing that. He wasn't mean. It's kind of fun.
It's just sort of funny.
He's actually kind of funny.
Yeah. It's like, it's still funny, right?
Yeah. It doesn't fit our brand. We're not hilarious.
Yeah.
Here's the other problem, though, is, like, Dan Le Batard is the only Miami fan that cares that much that LeBron left. Everybody else is like, oh, okay, so the Beach then? Or, like, was that the name of our basketball team? The Heat? What was his name? LeBonze Jordan? What was that guy's name? They don't care. They're the most fair-weather fans in the NBA. I'm sorry.
Well, like, they have other shit to do.
That's kind of my thing. Like, they're mad that he didn't thank Miami. I'm like, what is he going to thank him for leaving early?
Right? He won you two championships.
He did thank them, though.
Yeah. Despite the fact that, like, before he got there, none of you could give two shits about your own basketball team, despite the fact that you had Dwayne Wade. Like, I'm sorry. No, City of Miami, fuck off.
Like, Miami has no right to the largesse they've had over this last decade. I mean, they picked up Shaq and D. Wade got him a championship. They got two championships with LeBron, Wade, and Bosch. Well, LeBron and Wade. I mean, and they're not a city that really needs to thrive on sports. I mean, they have more. And I'm not trying. Fuck it, I'll say it. Cities that really need sports are cities you have nothing else to fucking do.
Yeah.
Like
Cleveland, for example.
Cleveland, Indianapolis.
Buffalo.
Anything where they used
to. Do you know what my argument was going to be? And then I realized that you were entirely right. I was going to be like, well, we have the Indy 500, and then I realized that's a sport. So, yeah, your argument is entirely valid.
Any place that used to make cars really needs sports right now. But you know what? New Orleans doesn't need sports.
No.
L.A. doesn't need sports.
No.
Miami doesn't.
I think that's why L.A. will never have a football team again. It's just like, no one cares, guys.
No, but you need to have...
Everybody beating the drum for it, that, like, small group of white capitalists are the only people that give a shit whether L.A. gets a professional football team again. Everybody else is like...
Yeah, also another reason why LA would probably never, there's no, like, glamour to attending a football game the way there is Laker games for celebrities.
Yeah, that's true. You can't feel like, oh, I'm sitting courtside right behind Jack Nicholson, and he smells awful.
Like, I mean, if I'm the NBA, NFL, I want more franchises like Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Things where people come out regardless. People just come out to see the games. They all dress in the same shirt. They're really into it because there's nothing fucking else in Oklahoma City.
Golden State's got really good fans.
Yeah, because they're in... Where are they in?
No, Oakland.
Oakland?
Yeah.
All I'll say is there's tons of shit to do in Milwaukee. So they should definitely keep their sports team. That
there's beer and cheese.
And
beer.
And going inside from the blizzard is the thing to do.
Well, moving on to a story that does actually make me very happy. The Spurs have hired a female assistant coach. Becky Hammond, who is currently playing for the WNBA San Antonio Stars, will retire after this, her 16th season, and take up the job of assistant coach with the Spurs next season, which makes her effectively the first female to be paid by the NBA as an assistant. And I gotta say this, man, the Spurs, they're the James Gunn of the NBA.
Class act.
They will hire the right person for the right role, whether it seems right to you or it doesn't, and they will prove us all wrong when we doubt them for it. Mm-hmm. That is entirely... And they've been doing that all along. They got guys from, like, leagues all over the country. Like, what was it, 90% of their team almost is foreign players. And people were like, why are you doing this? That's ridiculous.
Half of them don't speak English.
Half of them don't speak English. They've kept the same big three guys for the last, what, 10 years? More than 10 years?
Yeah, it's been a while.
12 years?
Yeah.
And it's like people, every year, will discount them. Every single year will discount them because of the moves that they, or the moves they don't really make, and the team that they put together, and the people that they hire. And then every year, they get proven wrong. And it reminds me of, like, when we were all like, what, Dave Bautista is going to be in the... What? And what, Vin Diesel is... This is stupid. What is he doing? And then we all saw Guardians of the Galaxy and went, oh, we're dumb. And James Gunn is smart.
Well, and the thing is, like, you can tell a lot about what you're going for by the pieces you're putting together.
Mm-hmm.
And people who were thinking Guardians of the Galaxy was going to be this, like, Michael Bay type... It's like, well, if you're looking at the pieces he's putting together, you got Chris Pratt as your main...
Oh, Chris Pratt. People heard Chris Pratt was going to be Star-Lord. It's like, isn't that chubby dude from Parks and Rec?
Yeah, it's like, I don't know. Like, you can sort of tell a lot. And the Spurs fundamentally are just they're a fundamentally sound team.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of luxuries you can have when you actually have one of the greatest coaches of all time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, when you have somebody like
Avery
that...
Johnson.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember him from NBA Jam.
Hey, you know what? Former Coach of the Year, Avery Johnson.
That's true. The interesting thing about Greg Popovich is similar to Bill Parcells. A lot of Pop's guys end up becoming NBA head coaches or GMs.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you learn the game.
Yeah.
I gotta applaud the Spurs, man. I can't believe that. I can believe it a little bit because professional sports is still largely a boys' club. But like, I honestly am surprised to find out that in 2014. We finally have the first female assistant coach in the NBA.
Well,
like, that's kind of crazy to me.
Well, if you look at it, sports is the last real boys club there is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was a story, I was listening to Rachel Select a few months ago, and there was a story where these, like, women weren't allowed in a certain gaming tournament because the gaming tournament was trying to get the game recognized as a sport, and to get it recognized as a sport, you had to have male and female divisions.
Yeah.
That was one of the international rules.
Yeah, I'm going to stop you there, video game world. Video games will never be sports. There are video games that are based on sports, but I've seen the people who play them for hours on end. And you know, star athlete is not the phrase I would use to describe those people.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to generalize, but I'm sorry. If you're actually trying to get me to take seriously the idea that a video game can be considered a sport, you're out of your goddamn mind.
I think a video game can be a sport.
And
if you're running on the power pad, maybe.
Yeah. No, I don't think a sport has to necessarily be physically strenuous.
I disagree with that. I don't think poker's a sport either.
Yeah.
I consider poker a sport.
See, I don't at
or
all.
Spelling.
It's
like
a game.
There's competitions and games. Not all those things are sports.
Yeah. Yeah. Sport to me, it signifies actual athletic effort.
I know the definition of the word sport, so technically a lot of things can qualify to be considered a sport, but... Though they really shouldn't be.
The
word sport should be just redefined in the Webster Dictionary, so things aren't actually considered sports.
But by your definition, would you consider marching band a sport?
No.
Is this physical?
No.
Okay.
No. Like,
I don't know.
Not like something being a physical activity doesn't make it a sport, nor necessarily something being competitive doesn't make it a sport.
See, I feel like the physical activity is like my minimum threshold for whether the discussion can even take place. And video games, by their nature, are just... games. It's in the name of the thing. It's a video game.
I don't think it would be anything on the level of, like, a triathlon, decathlon. But when you look at sports in the United States these days, it's more sports entertainment than anything else. So that's what I'm sort of defining it as.
I guess I would define a sport by the people who participate in the sport. So if a sport is actually participated by athletes, then it's a sport. If it's participated by people who are competitors, then it's just a game.
But then I'm not trying to get a lawyer on you, but then how do you define athlete?
I'm going to stop you because if you're using entertainment as your criteria for whether something is a sport, watching a movie then becomes a sport because movies are entertainment.
No, but you don't have people competing against each other to see how many movies they can watch. Unless it's you and Cargo.
You might. That still would not make watching movies a sport.
I completely reject that. You look at Korea, and they have...
I don't often, but I guess we are now, yeah.
They have, like, StarCraft tournaments where, like, the entire country watches.
Okay.
I consider that a sport.
That's not a sport. That's a thing that the entire country is watching that doesn't make it a sport.
They are going to love you on Rage Select.
Video games are not sports. Like, that's ridiculous. Yeah.
As far as Becky Hammon goes, like, if anyone's curious...
Oh, yeah, we should get back to the story that we were talking about.
If anyone's curious, like, right when I graduated, right out of high school,
Straight out of high school!
I watched sports the most. I love basketball so much. I would watch the WNBA from time to time. And so Becky Hammon is... I would compare her game and her basketball IQ to someone like John Stockton.
Nice.
So it's good
that she's an assistant coach.
Yeah. So people wonder about her transition to the game and whether or not the dudes will respect her. And I think basketball more than any sport. Like I'm not as familiar with like tennis or any other sports where you know men and women kind of do mingle. Basketball more so than any other sport utilizes the cliche of game recognized game. Like if you know the game, if you can play, like. A guy will respect you.
That's actually true. The NBA is faster, I guess, than the WNBA is, because it's played by men who are physically more capable, than women. But as far as strategy goes, as far as understanding exactly how you should play the game, it's the same one way or the other.
Yeah,
whether you're a woman or a man, like. That's actually pretty interesting. How it maybe has taken this long for a woman to break into the NBA, considering that. The game is so similar from women to men.
That's the only part of it that's a shame is that it's taken so long. But I think she's going to transition wonderfully into the game. And I've watched her play throughout a lot of her career, and she's very smart. And I think she'll do really well.
And if anything, a woman coming from the WNBA probably would be a better coach because I watch the WNBA, and they're more fundamentally sound. Mm-hmm. They actually pass the fucking ball. Their entire game isn't now. Give it to this person, see if things go off the ball.
So it makes even more sense that the first female assistant coach would be with the San Antonio Spurs.
Exactly.
A team that, like Adam said earlier, has been recognized time and time again for its fundamental play and its lack of showboating. So, yeah, no, I'm very excited about this. I do want to point out that we have no cyborgs this week, but we certainly have a frittata. Our frittata this week is Michael Beasley of the Miami Heat, who recently had his Porsche repossessed. Now, I know what you might be thinking, guys. It's really inappropriate because lots of athletes run into money troubles, and it is in no way cause to call their intelligence into question. Yeah. And you're right, listeners, except that that isn't even the situation here, because the Porsche wasn't repossessed for failure to pay the note. It was repossessed because it didn't belong to Michael Beasley. It was a rental that he never brought back.
Yeah.
Well, this isn't Blockbuster.
He had the money to buy his own damn Porsche because he is a professional basketball player with the Miami Heat. Instead, he rented the Porsche, and instead of continuing to rent it, just didn't bring it back by the agreed upon time. So the Hertz had to go out and get their own car back from him when he wouldn't bring it back.
I wonder if they sent OJ Simpson.
It's like in Nightfall when Batman's like, I broke my back, here Azrael, you take up the mantle, and then Azrael just won't give the shit back. So then there has to be, you know, Knights In where they fight each other. And,
wow, you really know that arc really well.
I love, like, dude, if there's one character I love above all else and one character I will actually be a comic book nerd about, it's Batman.
I thought you were gonna say Azrael.
Oh, I like Azrael too. Jean-Paul Valley's a cool guy.
Really?
Yeah. I like Azrael.
He's a douche.
What are you going to do? Well, I mean, he's a douche in that story arc for sure. But
okay.
Like, in his actual comic book, in his run, he was a cool character.
Okay.
I liked it. Cool. The Order of Saint Dumas. I can't believe I remember all that stuff.
Like, you're just like...
Yeah.
It's like I'm sitting next to Randy from Rose Gallery.
I know.
Games around Rock, Texas.
Rose Gallery, by the way, is going to host a Cards Against Humanity tournament during Fest of Us at Rose Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas.
Yeah.
So you're definitely, if you guys are coming in for Fest of Us, you're definitely going to want on Saturday night from 9 to midnight. We're shutting the store down and having a Cards Against Humanity tournament. It's going to be amazing.
God, I love that fucking store.
Bring your rented Porsches.
Bring your rented Porsches so you don't end up like Michael B. Like, seriously, how stupid do you have to be Like, do we think he forgot when he was supposed to bring it back? Because it seems like if they're sending out the tow trucks, this isn't a day late. This isn't 2 days late.
Probably like a month.
This is probably more like a month late. Yeah. Because they probably had to, you know, find the car first.
Well, you have to give them notice. So, like,
give notice.
They probably sent him a certified letter.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's like Charlie from Always Sunny, just doesn't know how to read.
Yeah.
Well, apparently he had racked up, like, he had owed $2,000 in rental fees on the car. So...
Yeah, I mean, it was due back, what, July 26th or something like that. So he's had it for, I guess, about a week, 2 weeks longer than he was supposed to. But seriously, like, if you're going to pay $2,000 just to have a Porsche over the course of a month, just buy a fucking Porsche.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, just buy a Porsche.
Yeah, I was going to say, and earlier you said you shouldn't make fun of, like, athletes for being stupid or whatever. You can make fun of Michael Beasley.
Yeah. That's true.
throughout his entire career, like that's been his MO. This is nothing new for Michael Beasley.
He is a candidate for a long running frittata, the frittata of the year, perhaps.
And while not frittata, want to just say you had a second chance, and your fucking up award is, I think, Greg Oden.
Oh yeah,
what did he do now?
Both of the Miami Heat discount bin free agents from the past year. Greg Oden allegedly punched a woman in the face.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
We call that Pac-Manning out. Yes. So, congratulations, Greg Oden. You are not only a complete bust out in the NBA, but you're a complete bust as a human being.
Yeah, I have a cyborg.
You fucking with my shit, Elliot. Sorry. Fucking my shit up. Who's your cyborg, Elliot? Now I want
to
know.
I have a great man who has done a great service to the nation. He's not a sports player. He's a cyborg in spirit. He was a man
the guy
who
bought all the...
Damn it!
I was joking.
No, you're right. Okay. It's the guy who he was standing in line at Burger King, and this kid was, like, whining. He's like, I fucking want my pies. He went and bought every fucking pie at that Burger King and walked the fuck out.
No, the way I read it is the kid was annoying him, being really loud.
He was saying curse words, saying, I fucking want my pie.
Yeah, and so the guy turned around and asked his mom, hey, will you... shut your kid up, and she didn't do anything, and so he bought all of the pies.
Damn right! That's how it goes!
And didn't give the kid any.
And I would have thrown that shit away. And like,
that's a Liz Lemon move. That's a Liz Lemon move for sure.
Yeah, continually Elliot hate kid. Yeah. Elliot hates kids.
Sorry for stepping on you. I was totally joking.
Did you step on his toes as he was stepping on mine?
I step on his toes. It's like the
human centipede of toe stepping.
No, that's my fault. I didn't tell you that I had somebody I wanted for Cyborg. It's on me.
Well, we have we don't have a name for this next topic, for this next segment, but it's going to be a semi-regular one, and we're actually bringing in some help to help us cover this. We're actually going to start covering, as many of you have been asking for, we're going to start covering MMA on Inside the Locker, but as none of us really have the time or the money to pay for the pay-per-views for MMA, we actually have a special correspondent by the name of Vincent Smith, who also does Heavy Meta now for us on oneofus.net as a former Lounge Geeks column. And he reached out and said, you know, you guys don't cover MMA on the show. Is that something you'd like to? And I was like, well, we need a good correspondent. So we're going to bring Vince in right now and let him tell us what is going on in the world of MMA. Take it away, man.
All right. Well, we've had a couple of different exciting events coming down the pipe in the past couple of weeks. The most recent UFC Fight Night had a couple of interesting results that have some serious impact on a couple of different divisions. For one, Anthony Rumble Johnson, who formerly fought at 170 pounds, though I have no idea if, like, they cut off one of his legs prior to weigh-in and then sewed it back on, because he's fighting at 205 right now and holy cutting shit down to get there.
Wow.
So... he was pretty much just torturing his body to get to that point. He fought at heavyweight. He knocked out Andre Arlovsky at heavyweight, who is a former UFC heavyweight champion and a top 10 heavyweight still, even though he's been in the fight game for a decade. And so at 205, he has got some scary, ridiculous power. Just... are you guys familiar with Chuck Liddell?
Yes, the Iceman.
Yeah, he's the only one who I can really compare this kind of, like, scary god hand that Rumble has.
The god hand? Is that like the Infinity Gauntlet? Is that what you mean by the god hand?
It might as well be. I mean, like, Galactus has got to have a hell of a jaw to be able to take a shot from that.
Do they call him Kingslayer?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, we're just going to keep doing this.
If it's on John Jones, which they're thinking of coming up, then you might very well be able to call him that, because he took on the youngest of the Nogueira brothers, Antonio Rogério Nogueira, last night. He was known for some of his technical boxing in the 205-pound division, and he just, you saw from the moment that he clipped him with a single shot, his head snapped back, and it was just like, you might as well just hit him with a truck. As much as I don't feel good for anyone getting pushed in the face, I can't imagine that, like, I don't know if you guys have watched a whole lot of fights, but there's a certain look in the eyes of a fighter when they get punched by someone and they're like,
hilarious.
I did not know that this guy could punch that hard.
And it makes
and
that sound.
That moment of, oh dear God, what have I gotten myself into?
Totally ringing a bell.
They get his bell rung, absolutely.
You sound like a computer version of Morgan Freeman in Million Dollar Baby.
Freeman in that movie was Master Control Program.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
There's a part where the judge says, we'll talk about this another day.
Okay, so with this win over Little Nog, it actually creates a really interesting situation at 205 pounds, because the big fight coming up is going to be the current champion, John Jones, who is also currently, I believe, the number one pound-for-pound ranked fighter in the world. Taking on Daniel Cormier in what's going to be a really, really interesting fight. But I'll get into that in a moment, because it's this kind of weird situation where around, like, from the number 5 ranked seed downwards, it's pretty much anyone's game. But in terms of one guy who's gone on a really impressive streak, there hasn't really been one. So Rumble's only had 2 fights since he's come back in the UFC, but they've both been impressive KOs. But they haven't been against top 5 or top 3 contenders. So he might very well end up getting a title shot, but whether or not he'd be able to keep up with someone of John Jones' caliber in terms of technical striking, I don't really know. But it creates a very interesting equation.
Well, if I can compare it to something, because that's what I do, and that's pretty much all I do. So you're talking about a guy who hasn't had a lot of fights, you know, has had only these 2 fights, but have been really impressive. I kind of look at that situation as like a Tony Jaa or an Iko Uwe situation, because Iko has really only had 2 movies that American audiences have been familiar with, The Raid and The Raid 2, but in both of those has proven to be an amazing martial artist. And when Tony, and that's great, and, you know, we're going to see if that trend continues, or if he does something like Tony Jaa, who came out with The Protector and Ong Bak, which were both really impressive movies, but then after that, every movie after that is just worse and worse. So we want a more Iko path and a less Tony Jaa path.
And a less Taylor Kitsch path.
And a way less Taylor Kitsch path, absolutely.
So much less Taylor Kitsch.
Yeah, that's a valid comparison for sure. Though I think the main thing here is that it's not as if Rumble Johnson isn't a really, really impressive martial artist. It's just you have a certain point where he has that Mike Tyson type power and athleticism that he can, like, pretty much barrel through 90% of the guys that he fights. But then you have him fight a guy like John Jones, who has both the same kind of wrestling acumen, well probably better, actually. He's an NCAA, I forget if he's like a Big 5 finalist, but elite level wrestler, who has also turned into one of the most creative and unorthodox strikers in the world. In addition to that natural athleticism, like pretty much the only thing, if I'm going to play MMA math here, that Rumble Johnson has over John Jones is the fact that, like, he can put you down with anything he hits you with. But Jones has incredible reach and an ability to control distance that very few fighters have. He does this, one thing he's been criticized for is just kind of, he holds his lead hand open palmed outward, And it's pretty much the little, like, you know, when you're fighting with your younger sibling and you're holding them at arm's length and they can't hit you.
That's exactly what this sounds like.
That's pretty much what he does, but he's, and the reason why he's been criticized for it is because eye pokes have become a really big problem in mixed martial arts, and he does it with his hand open because he's parrying the jab or whatever straight hand that the opponent tries to throw at him. But when he does so, a lot of the time they get a thumb in the eye or they get a finger in the eye. And one prominent former fighter and really interesting commentator, Boss Rutten, actually commented on the fact that, like, okay, he does it, he does this parrying hand intentionally, and this has happened enough times so that, like, he's aware that he's doing this, but he's not changing it. And while it may not be malicious, it's sort of like, it's kind of bad form, if you know what I mean.
It's a little Belichick. It's a little Belichickian.
And speaking of bad form, I don't know, that's a horrible segue.
Yeah.
How would he do against Drax the Destroyer? Because he used to be an MMA fighter, right?
For like a couple of matches, I think. Not a lot.
He was a professional wrestler. Batista is a professional wrestler.
No, but he was a fighter for a second.
He had a bit of an MMA career.
Batista has a couple of MMA fights, or at least he was training for MMA. I think that John Jones would utterly and completely destroy him.
He would Drax to destroy him.
To be quite honest. I mean, it's funny. There have been a couple of fights with guys who were like World's Strongest Man competition winners and that sort of thing, who tried to switch over to mixed martial arts. And the thing that always happens with them is that they are just a human wrecking ball for about the first 30 seconds. And then you just kind of see their entire body turn red from the blood and they just kind of run out of gas. And between that and just a lot of elite athletes, you know, to put it not in the most eloquent way, a lot of them don't adapt well to getting punched in the face. And
in the immortal words of Mike Tyson, everybody's got a plan until you get punched in the face.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't think any of us in this room could say that we adapt well to being punched in the face.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the guy from Goon.
I've actually been punched in the face by dudes who get punched in the face for a living, which is why I have so much respect for them.
And so much brain damage?
I'm maybe fear?
Yeah,
I don't know. Was that what I would have?
I don't know.
I mean, I would respect most people that punch me in the face, too.
It's like, I totally respect you!
It's just, I respect you, that is why you fail. yeah, I'll move on to the John Jones Cormier fight since we're still on that. And
are we talking about the fight they're going to have or the fight they had during media day?
Oh God, it's kind of what's the word I'm looking for here? It's kind of a bittersweet feeling because in one side of thing, I was kind of proud of the MMA fan community because a lot of people went on Twitter and were just like, dude, come on. Like, what are you guys? This is high school? Like, come on. Do your fighting in the ring. Act like adults outside of it. But then I see, you know, the actual guys who are going to be fighting in the ring getting in each other's faces, and I have the exact same reaction. But it's kind of being promoted as like, oh, these guys are going to tear each other apart. And the odd thing is, the more shit that gets talked before a fight oftentimes leads to a surprisingly boring fight. And
this is sounding more and more like Mike Tyson, Lennox Lewis, like, yeah. the way you keep describing it.
Yeah, I mean, they were doing the thing where, like, they weren't kissing, but they might as well could have. I mean, change the background music, and there you go.
I fooled around and fell in love.
I wish I knew how to hit you.
That's a good one. I like that one. Yeah, just on that sort of level, I'm beginning to think that John Jones is kind of following the footsteps of Tito Ortiz in that this is very much a part of his game. Because when he fought Rashad Evans before, there was a huge feud leading up to their fight about, like, they were, I believe, opposite coaches on the Ultimate Fighter reality show, and they were almost getting into brawls on there. And then when the fight came, John Jones controlled the distance, parried Rashad's jabs and straights, moved out of the way, and beat him up with elbows for five rounds, and not a whole lot happened. And I think the reason for that is because no one wants to talk a whole bunch of shit and then get overly aggressive, come out, and then just get clocked and dropped. Because, again, you kind of look like an asshole, so...
Yeah, I've seen YouTube videos of guys doing that, and it's they do look like assholes, and I do laugh a lot, so there is that. But kind of, you know, summing up the things you've been saying here, Vince, can you give us a quick rundown... really quickly in summation of the fighters that if we are new to MMA, if it's not something we watch very often, the fighters that we should be keeping an eye on right now?
Oh, right now? I think pretty much going down the pound-for-pound list right now is actually a really good way to look at it. I'm someone who's a big fan of particularly technical fights. I love a good brawl as much as anyone, but the guys who... really put the art back into martial arts are the ones that I think that people should really look out for. If people can find, in particular, a video of the fight TJ Dillashaw versus Henan Barao, it is, I've watched it 3, 4, 5 times because it's just a striking clinic of footwork and evasiveness, switching stances, fakes, everything. So TJ Dillashaw... if a slightly older fighter, but if you can find video on Dwayne Ludwig, he, first of all, he owns the record for the fastest knockout in UFC history. I think it's like 5 or 6 seconds.
Was he fighting me?
It was one of those things where the other guy came out overly aggressive and ran directly into a jab, so it struck with twice the force. And then the guy struck the ground with just about as much force.
And there's the other hit, yep.
So, yeah, and also kind of the connecting point here is that Dwayne Ludwig was the one who trained TJ Dillashaw, who just took out the, I believe it's 135 is the weight class that they were fighting at. And before then, Henan Barao was undefeated for 9 years. He had a record of something like 29-1. And there's just... everyone was talking about him like, no one wants to fight this guy. This guy's scary. He's scary everywhere. Huge knockout power. Throwing, like, knockout spin kicks. He's a monster on the ground. And Dillashaw comes in, massive underdog, and puts on what I can only describe as a beautiful performance, because it's really what it was. It's like there wasn't really a whole lot of like him bullying him around and using brute strength. It was just every time Henan Barao threw something, he wasn't there, and every time he was off balance, countered with 2-3 shots, got out. That's one particular video I'd say look out for. Another one would be any fight that involves the current UFC flyweight champion, Demetrius Mighty Mouse Johnson.
That's a good nickname.
He's 5'3", so...
oh my god.
He's on the pound-for-pound list, but I think that, you know, no pun intended, he gets kind of overlooked.
First of all, every single pun is intended. I want that on record. There's no such thing as no pun intended.
Right. I forgot what show I'm on.
There you go.
Damn right.
But, yeah, he's another guy who, exquisite timing, he is so fast. Like, there have been a couple of times when I'm watching his fights, and the timing on his takedowns when he counters other guys, like, if you watch the 125-pounders, it's like watching one of those old Looney Tunes cartoons where you see, like, the big dust cloud and then, like, fists and hands and, like, all that sort of stuff sticking out of it. But he makes everyone else in that division look like they're moving in slow motion. And it's not as if he's throwing really wild haymakers. He is top 2 or 3 in just about every discipline that makes up MMA. Joe Rogan often comments that if you want to teach a new fighter how to fight correctly, you show him footage of Demetrius Johnson.
Nice. Wow. All right. Well, those are certainly fighters we will have to watch out for. And I have another MMA, a very technical MMA question for you. Are you Canadian?
Indeed I am.
Aha! I knew it. I heard the outs and the abouts. I could hear it from a mile away.
He is quite polite.
He is, and he's very polite, so clearly he's Canadian, because why would any American
red-blooded American boy be a polite person. That's just not how we were raised.
It plays with the theory that Canada is just basically the light beer version of America.
Well, no, the polite beer version of America. Yes, indeed.
You call us polite if you want, but hey, we've been apparently turning into a factory for, like, some trained killers in the past few years, so comedians and MMA fighters, apparently, are, like, our two main exports.
And basketball players.
And basketball players.
You still need to apologize once again for Bryan Adams.
I think Justin Bieber. I think we've gotten over Bryan Adams because of Justin Bieber. Oh. So, take back Justin Bieber. That is my urging to you, sir. But, Vince, I want to thank you so much for coming. We've got to come up with a name for this segment, because I know we're going to make this a sort of semi-regular thing. So, I want you to think about that, Vince. And then the next time we do this segment, we'll have a name, we'll have a jingle, we'll have the whole nine yards.
That sounds great.
All right, thanks a lot, man. We're going to take a short break before our main segment and to reorganize our 1998 World Series commemorative POG collection. But don't you go anywhere, because much like we didn't know we should have been saying about the Planet of the Apes franchise just a few years ago, the best is yet to come. This is Inside the Locker on oneofus.net.
Hi, I'm Jason Newlander, and I've created a new fictional podcast on the oneofus.net podcast network called Salt. If you're a fan of crime noir with a little sci-fi thrown in, then I think this just might be your thing. Jean-Pierre Desperoir is a Haitian-born salt smuggler living in 1931 Tunis and born during a voodoo ritual with the uncanny ability to travel through space and time. Think The Big Sleep meets 12 Years a Slave meets Doctor Who, and you've got the idea. 20 half-hour episodes tell the first season story, and I promise it's a doozy. Salt podcasts every other week on the oneofus.net podcast network. Subscribe today.
And as we come back from break, I want to remind you guys that as we're recording this, as this is happening right now, preseason football is being played, which means we are so close, you guys. Oh my God, so close to the NFL being back. I can taste it. I can taste pigskin, and I can taste overpriced beer, and I can taste fury in the fourth quarter from Andrew Luck. Like, I can taste it all. I'm so excited. I'm so excited.
Blaine Gabbert's still really bad.
I can taste how bad Blaine Gabbert will remain. Oh, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be an amazing season.
I taste Dallas despair.
And Adam, of course, tasting Dallas despair, as he does every year.
I can taste the grass on Death Valley.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. And as we move into our main topic, it's actually born of something we talked about last week. We were talking about sort of moving things around and implying free agency to create new superhero movies, newer and bigger superhero movies, which of course led us to the discussion about the summer movie season and how this summer movie season has stacked up to summer movie seasons in the past. And I decided to use, so what we're going to do on this segment is we're basically going to go back through the summers, and I chose kind of 2008 as the jumping off point, as sort of the, that's how far back we would go, because that was really the launch of the Marvel Renaissance with Iron Man.
Yeah.
So I think it's a pretty... Plus, it was also the summer that gave us The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in a lot of ways, everything before that is kind of inconsequential.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, in one summer we got... and I'm going to go back through... I don't really know a format to do this in, so I'm just going to start with 2008 and talk about the best and the worst of that year. In the best category, like I said, we have Iron Man. We had The Dark Knight. We also had The Incredible Hulk. In the comedy realm, we had Pineapple Express, we had Tropic Thunder, we had Hancock, we had Forgetting Sarah Marshall, we also had WALL-E, Hellboy 2, Kung Fu Panda, like a pretty decent lineup. Now, what I have found in my research going back through each individual year is one of the things that I wanted to see is, I left out as outliers, I left out all of the mediocre films. And I know that's very subjective, you guys may not have picked the same movies I did.
Sense.
But I left out all the movies that I thought would only register, you know, a kind of meh, or, oh, that wasn't very good, or it was okay. I left all the mediocre films out, and I just went with what I considered the best and the worst of these years. And what I found is that even doing that, the worst always, always, like, magnificently out-trumps the best.
Like Journey to the Center for 2008.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so I just read off all the best ones I had. The worst, this is the list of Leatherheads, Prom Night, What Happens in Vegas, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, Sex in the City, Don't Mess with the Zohan, The Happening, Get Smart, The Love Guru, Journey to the Center of the Earth, Meet Dave, The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, Sister of the Traveling Pants 2, House Bunny, Babylon AD, and Disaster Movie.
Well, I mean...
Yep.
The... You read my awfully fast. I forgot
those are movies.
No, Get Smart wasn't that bad.
Okay, so we'll take Get Smart out of the equation.
Yeah, Get Smart's a man. I think Leatherheads is also a man.
Zohan wasn't that bad.
Zohan was terrible. I'm sorry, that one stays.
There's another one you said. Read that again, just real quick.
So the new list is Prom Night. What Happens in Vegas?
King what Happens in Vegas wasn't that bad.
Nope, I'm sorry. Yes, it is. Right. That stays on there.
That was a fun movie.
I will grant you the other two and take them off, but we're still at least a 2-to-1 differential.
No, you're right, you're right.
And I feel like that's going to happen. I was going to use that as a criteria for deciding which of the
summers. Big hard cuts, Elliot. Hard cuts.
I've watched What Happens in Vegas at least 5 times. I like that movie.
Oh, for God's sake. You're the only person, and I include Ashton Kutcher in this. You are the only person who has watched that movie 5 times.
It's a fun movie.
You stand alone, Elliot. And it's good to stand alone in certain categories.
Okay, have you watched it, or was it chosen for you, and you chose not to change the channel?
No, I actively went and bought it.
Oh, you bought it.
Okay, all right.
I own it on Blu-ray.
I'll give him that because the year that Ghost of Girlfriend's Past came out, I kind of put that on my list. Only because...
That's a good movie.
It is a good movie. But I only put that on my list because I have a feeling that for that year, Brian was going to put...
Why are you trying to do my work for me? Why are you trying to get ahead of me?
By the way, actually, I think this is 2008, right?
This is 2008, yeah.
I believe Anchorman was also the summer of 2008.
That was way earlier.
No, it wasn't.
I was still in college when Anchorman came out.
What?
It was way earlier, yeah.
Yeah, this sequel that we just got last year, one of the big things about it is it had been 9 years. It was 2004.
Yeah.
Because it had been 9 years since they had made the previous one.
I remember I was working when it came out at the theater, and... Yeah. The audience for Anchorman were some of the most annoying little shits you've ever seen. All these people are like,
well, they couldn't get
so
into what happens in Vegas,
time.
So they went to smack
you with a bag of popcorn.
So we're working in about a 2-to-1 ratio of really great films that year and really terrible films. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's not even really a fair criteria because the summer movie season is so choked week in and week out with just garbage, mm-hmm. that it's really hard to expect a summer season to have nothing but good films. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that summer may be, as I'm looking over all my notes here, maybe the closest, arguably maybe 2013, as far as having as many great films as there are bad films. Like, the margin is a lot narrower in this year than in most of the other years we're going to talk about.
See, I use a different metric.
What metric do you use?
The metric I use is not so much great film versus bad films or mediocre films. I look for the movies that I remember years later.
Okay, okay.
So, for me, 2008 is pretty much known for Iron Man and Dark Knight. 2009 is for one of my favorite movies of all time, the new Star Trek.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yep.
Even though it takes a lot of shortcuts and it's sort of cheap sometimes, it's still amazing. And then 2013, obviously, Pacific Rim. So it's like, I mean, that's what I sort of noticed. Because, like, you don't remember the mediocre films from 82. You remember the great movies. So that's what I look for is, what are the movies that made a mark on cinema that you're like, I remember that shit for the rest of my life?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could make the argument, too, with Pineapple Express. Because Pineapple Express kind of relaunched James Franco's career.
That's true.
He had been around for a while, but that was the first time we saw him in a movie. And Hollywood started to see him as a viable comedic commodity.
Yeah.
And I feel like Seth Rogen, to a certain extent, of course, Knocked Up was his big launch into stardom, but I feel like Pineapple Express was a serious shot in the arm for his career as well. Yeah.
Pineapple Express is one that it kind of occurred to me, because I rewatch it fairly frequently, and it wasn't until this last time that I rewatched it a couple months ago where it's like, I sit down and rewatch this movie fairly frequently. Like, yeah. This movie holds up really well.
Absolutely. Absolutely, it does. And so we move on to the summer of 2009. And we've got the best, and I feel like this is where the disparity is greatest for my metric, because when I think about the best films of the 2009 summer season, and again, I want to stress that we're talking about April to August, because April is the new start of the summer season, and has been for several years.
Yeah, beginning of April now.
Yeah, and now even March is kind of like bleeding, and I won't...
And 2009 really kind of kicked it off, because I'm noticing that Fast and Furious opened April 3rd. That year.
Is that 5?
That's about right.
Yeah, that's the fourth one.
Fourth
God.
One.
Five,
but 5 is the one that had the tagline, summer begins in whatever date that opened.
Yeah. So, okay, in 2009, as far as the best movies, and if I'm leaving anything out that you guys think should be included, just let me know. But I got Star Trek, I got Up, I got The Hangover, 500 Days of Summer, District 9, and Glorious Bastards are the kind of the movies that I think were the best of that summer.
Yeah, District 9.
Really?
Oh, I hate that
movie. Wait, so yes, What Happens in Vegas, no District 9.
I hate District 9 so goddamn much.
I
just don't like that director.
It's like you're a robot. I don't even know. I feel like I should be giving, like, tell me about your mother. If you saw a turtle on its back, what would you do?
My problem with District 9 is that I think at a certain point in that movie, you're rooting against humanity. It's like, look, they're really smart fucking aliens. If they found out what we did, we're fucked.
And you're okay with humanity and what happens in Vegas? I'm sorry, that had to be made.
Either I'm going to be destroyed. Yes, I am. Because you know what? It involves divorce lawyers.
Okay. I will say this. If you watch What Happens in Vegas and don't root against humanity for making that movie, I feel like there's a problem. And then in the category of worst movies that year, and again, just throw out, like, this list is fucking huge. 2009 was a garbage barge.
Garbage
dick. We had garbage Dragon Ball barge. Garbage barge. We had Dragon Ball Evolution, Hannah Montana the movie, Observe and Report, Crank High Voltage, Obsessed, X-Men Origins Wolverine, Angels and Demons, Dance Flick, Night of the Museum 2, Terminator Salvation, Land of the Lost, Imagine That, The Proposal, Year One, Transformers 2, I Love You, Beth Cooper, G-Force, Orphan, The Ugly Truth, Aliens in the Attic, The First G.I. Joe, A Perfect Getaway, Shorts, The Final Destination, which was the fourth one, and Rob Zombie's Halloween 2.
You don't like Observer and Report?
That's a creepy fucking movie.
No, I don't like it. I'll take it out.
I would say that one's right. I would say I wouldn't lump that in with that pile of shit.
Yeah, The Proposal.
And I think Crank High Voltage is way too ridiculous to consider that, like, complete shit.
You fucking apologists for... What are those guys' names? The two motorcycle directors?
Don't get me wrong. I got
Ghost Rider.
No,
Neville Dean and Taylor. Dean and Taylor apologists, every single one of them.
Sounds like about Neville Chamberlain, like we're on Fox News.
Neville Chamberlain. So, but
everything else on there can, you know, get flushed down the toilet.
Yeah. So
the proposal?
Yes, The Proposal, Elliot. I'm sorry.
The Proposal.
You do not
movie.
Get to comment on romantic comedies anymore. You are way too lenient. You are way too lenient on those movies, Elliot. I love you to death, but you're a hopeless romantic.
That's what I am. I'll freely admit it.
But we're still operating at about a 4-to-1 differential that year. And even the best movies, I think you really have Star Trek and Up.
That's it.
And, I mean, like, The Hangover, 500 Days of Summer, District 9, and Glory. Okay, so I would say Star Trek, Up, and District 9 are, like, the legitimately great movies in that group. Mm-hmm. And everything else definitely qualifies as the best of that year. Yeah. But, I mean, you're talking about three solidly great films to judge that summer by.
Yeah. And The Hangover gave us the reemergence of bros going to Vegas.
True, but you can't argue...
Which, I'm not arguing that's a good thing.
It's not, but what I'm saying... I know you were saying it was a bad thing. Okay. What I would say is you can't argue, though, that movie as a comedy... is incredibly strong. It's very well written. The jokes are very well executed. The ensemble of those four guys, like, it became a model. And I think they did a really great job with that first one. They liked it so much that they did the exact same movie again with the second one.
Shot for shot.
Like, the same. Everything is the same. Every single thing about that movie is the same. That's even the big joke at the end is, oh, everything happened the exact same way again. Isn't that funny? It's like, no, it means you have a lazy screenwriter. Go write Turtles.
My problem with Hangover 2 was there was a part... there was a part where it's like, the first one, you can still get married.
Mm-hmm.
The second one, you better tell your future wife what happened to you.
Yeah.
Like, the way you took it. Like, that's what you gotta tell her, because you shouldn't be getting married at that point if she's not okay with that.
Yeah. Well, let's look at it like this. So let's just take 2008 and 2009 and declare a winner. I don't even think it's a question.
2008.
As much as I like Star Trek, like, and Up, The Dark Knight and Iron Man will trump those two. Then you still have a handful of great films in 2008.
Yeah. I don't even know if you put Step Brothers in the list of best, but...
I that was a mediocre one for me.
I think... Because you know how I am with comedies, and like I put a lot of value in stuff I can rewatch. I can rewatch Step Brothers all the damn time.
Hated Step Brothers the first time I saw it, but yeah, the more I rewatch it, the more I like it.
So not only are there more great movies in 2008... But that ratio that we're talking about, the differential between the best and the worst, is a lot narrower in 2008 than it was in 2009. So yeah, I think right now 2008 is our front runner. As we move into 2010,
that's a bad year.
Yeah, it's not a great year. Not a great year. I'll start with the worst of this year, and you guys stop me if you hear something that doesn't belong on this list. You got Clash of the Titans. You got The Last Song. You got Tyler Perry's Why Did I Get Married 2. You got the remake of Death at a Funeral. You got the Backup Plan. Furry Vengeance. Oh, dear God. And even though I liked it, in full deference, I put A Nightmare on Elm Street, the remake, on here because I know so many people hated it.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. I like it,
but I completely understand that I am in the vast minority on that one. Iron Man 2. Yes, I put it as one of the worst of the summer. Shrek Forever After. Prince of Persia. Sex in the City 2. Killers, again with Ashton Kutcher. Sorry, Elliot. Marmaduke.
Hey, I think that's shit, too. That's Katherine Heigl.
There you go. Marmaduke, Jonah Hex, Grown Ups, Night and Day, The Last Airbender, Twilight Eclipse, Predators, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, Standing Ovation.
Predators was good.
I kind of like.
All right, I'll take Predators out. I'll take. I did not like Predators, but I will take that.
I kind of like The Sorcerer's Apprentice. I like Jay Baruchel.
Yeah, you do like Jay Baruchel.
I'm not saying
Sorcerer's Apprentice is way too harmless.
I'm totally not saying you should take it out. I like it.
It's way too. I like Adams.
It's way too harmless to be considered a terrible movie.
Yeah.
there was a decent movie you had at the beginning of that list.
Like.
Which one?
Read the beginning real quick.
Clash of the Titans?
No.
Why Did I Get Married 2?
Keep going.
The Backup Plan?
No. Not for Revenge. Keep
Shrek going. Forever After?
No.
Prince of Persia?
No.
Marmaduke?
No.
Night and Day? The Last Airbender? Twilight? Eclipse? That's pretty... I mean... What did I miss? Furry Vengeance? Death at a Funeral?
There was one you said that it was like... It's you thought it was on the border, but it was...
I don't.
I'm sorry.
No, I mean Iron Man 2. Maybe
Iron Man 2. I don't think that qualifies as a bad movie.
It's bad. Marvel.
I'll take it off only because that's
bad Marvel.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
It's not a bad movie.
That's not fair. You're right. That's not fair. The Cats and Dogs: The Revenge of Kitty Galore. Dinner for Schmucks. Eat, Pray, Love. Vampires Suck. The Switch. Lottery Ticket. And Takers.
Oh, Takers is bad.
Takers, the movie where T.I. becomes the bad audience member at one point.
That is the movie, when I wrote the article about that movie, about its cast, is that it was like the opposite of The Expendables, because every time The Expendables casting came out, like a new actor was added, people got really excited, and they did the same thing with Takers, and it was like, nobody cared, so it's where I coined the phrase, the who's who of who gives a shit, and
they wasted.
I think that phrase has served me pretty well.
They wasted Idris Elba in that movie.
Well, so did Obsessed, which... Oh, have we gotten there?
That was one of the most racist films I think I've seen in a very long time.
Single black female?
Obsessed is 2009.
Obsessed.
Yeah, 2009, Obsessed.
I have it on my list.
No, it's on mine, too. We definitely mentioned it. Or as I call it, single black female.
Oh, as I call it, let's market to every black female ever.
Yep.
It's like, your black man's going to leave you for a white woman.
All right, so we just ran down the list of the worst movies of 2010. Now, in my best column, I have things like Kick-Ass, The A-Team... Toy Story 3, Despicable Me, Inception, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, and The Last Exorcism.
Still not very good.
See, for Scott Pilgrim, The A-Team, Despicable Me, I think, yeah, there isn't a lot of movies in the best for that year, but I think the movies that are great are fucking amazing. Like, Scott Pilgrim is very high.
I would say there are three movies on this best of list that are, in my mind, unequivocally phenomenal films. Toy Story 3,
yeah.
Inception, and Scott Pilgrim vs. the World.
Inception, really?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I like Inception. I like it. I just don't...
You don't... I think it's on so many levels, is a phenomenal achievement in cinema, and is one of the most entertaining sci-fi movies I've seen in a long time, so...
Yeah, I like it a lot. I just don't consider it that memorable.
I mean, I think everything about that movie is they literally, like, have a fight sequence that defies gravity and was, like, the centerpiece of the film. Like, I think there's a lot that's memorable about that movie.
It's a little convoluted, but I think it's made really well. And
Jogo's vests are very memorable.
I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I actually like it a lot. I just don't consider it, for me, like, something that, like, I go back to all the time.
That's fair.
You are out there, man. I got to give you credit for that. I love it. You're gonna spin right off this planet, as Ari once said to Gary Busey. You're just gonna spin right off this planet, aren't you?
But I won't stop spinning, so you'll know I actually meet.
There you go. So, very good. Very good. I like that. So now we have 2000. Now we have 2008 against 2010, and I again, like, Toy Story, Inception, Scott Pilgrim, great movies, but do they stand up against The Dark Knight, Iron Man, The Incredible Hulk, WALL-E?
No,
they don't.
No, I think 2008 is still our front runner. Yeah, as we move in,
takes it.
As we move into 2011, which, to its credit, has a veritable bevy of great films.
Oh yeah,
we have Insidious, we have The King's Speech, and I want to point to this. No, hold on. I think it is a great movie. I don't know that I would necessarily agree that it was the best movie of that year. In fact, I very much don't agree that it is. But I do think it's impressive that the Best Picture winner that year was released in the summer. Because that doesn't usually happen. And I think
I don't remember it getting released in the summer.
It totally did. And then they re-released it.
Hurt Locker did that too.
Yeah.
I irrationally hold grudges against some movies, and King's Speech is one of them, because it took the Oscar
bought the Oscar.
Yeah, and it's why I don't really like Toy Story 3, because it took the animated Oscar away from How to Train Your Dragon.
I don't know if it took it away.
Story 3 deserved it.
Yeah, I think so.
That garbage dump scene earned it.
Yeah. Fuck Toy Story 3.
See, now, look, I'm the shitty person for not liking that kid.
No, well, yes. But JC, they both made you cry. Both those movies made you cry. Just get over it. They're both great films.
Toothless is like my cat at home.
I know. Right? It's like everybody's cat, even me, and I don't have a cat. So,
as a single man, like, we're not objective about How to Train Your Dragon. We're just not. No. Like, and the same thing can be said for people with families. Like, they're not objective about Toy Story 3, but when you come about emotional weight, the scene where they're about to get fucking incinerated,
yeah,
and like they just accept their fate. That I haven't seen that done in animation in the West almost ever.
Yeah, so. No, absolutely. So okay, so we got Insidious, The King's Speech, Fast Five. Yep, had to put it in the best of that summer.
You're damn
so.
Right, yeah.
Thor, which
yes, my favorite Marvel movie.
Thor, and we had Kung Fu Panda 2, which I thought was also very good.
Oh yeah,
X-Men First Class. Deathly Hallows Part 2, which was such a great wrap-up for that franchise. Yeah. Captain America the First Avenger.
Yep.
Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And I'm going to put it out there. You may not agree with me, but Fright Night. The remake of Fright Night.
Fright Night was good.
Put that on mine. Fan-damn-tastic.
Yeah, it was really good.
I put, as far as, because Ellie and I like romantic comedies, I put Crazy Stupid Love as...
I haven't seen that yet. I haven't watched it.
That is a good romantic comedy.
That's a very
friend.
Good romantic comedy. No, it's definitely rewatchable.
You're one ally on this, and he hasn't seen it.
Well, I don't like watching those movies where
you saw it.
That's right. I'm
sorry, I forgot about Adam because he's in the Barca Lounger behind us on the special.
You put me here.
No, it's awesome. I kind of want to sit back.
You put beef nuggets in the corner.
Nobody puts beef nuggets in the corner.
Did you say for the best Attack the Block?
Oh,
really? Wikipedia, that came up in the summer of that year.
It did. I forgot because we saw it at a film festival. I forgot when it actually came out.
And this is 2011 or 2012?
This is 2011.
2011, a lot of good
movies. So 2011 takes it from 2008.
Well, hold on. First, we got to talk about the worst.
Oh, okay.
And the worst of 2011 is as follows. Hop, Arthur, Scream 4, Madea's Big Happy Family, Water for Elephants, Dylan Dog, Hoodwinked 2, Jumping the Broom, Priest.
Jumping the Broom was not bad.
I will take that off just because I gave you so much shit about liking those terrible romantic comedies.
Well, Jumping the Broom actually covers a big problem in the black community of you have the upper class not relating to the lower class and just how you reconcile that.
I may have thought this was a different Jumping the Broom because
yeah, that's the one with El DeBarge is in the opening scene and
Patton. Okay, I have no idea what this movie is. I thought this was that stupid animated film about
No.
Take that one out. I don't know if it's on your list for the worst, but put Something Borrowed in there.
Something Borrowed.
That is a shit movie.
That is an awful romantic comedy, and I'm glad that you hate it. I was really worried for a second.
We're looking for
I don't have horrible tastes. I just have untraditional tastes.
I think it's somewhere between like, not to the level of horrible, but I think non-traditional is being a little polite.
And you can't say acquired either.
Look, everybody's taste is based on their life experiences. Okay? Like, I like certain movies for...
So apparently you are Sandra Bullock, and that's why you like all of these movies. Your life experience is that you're Sandra Bullock.
Let me explain the proposal. I saw the proposal for the first time on Christmas morning when my sister got it for Christmas, and it was a good family moment, so I remember it in that context.
Okay. Okay, I can buy that.
Like, everything for me is context in how I see the movie.
No, it's not context, it's classical conditioning. You have been conditioned, like Pavlov, to like these movies. Is like you associate the movie with that experience, which makes sense, totally. But I'm starting to understand, Elliot. I'm starting to get to the bottom of this.
It's not so much it's
to
more,
the creamy nougat center of Elliot Fontanet.
It's more that what that movie's aiming for. If that movie is aiming for a feel good movie, it's fine with me. I don't go back and watch The Proposal all the time, but I watch it again. And Ryan Reynolds is pretty funny. And Sandra Bullock's not bad. You got Betty White acting a fool. It's not bad. I think sometimes like regular movies that aren't really trying that much, just working by a formula, they get a bit of a bad rap.
But what they are trying, they're going.
It's like the gymnast who goes for an easy routine, but hits that easy routine. I'm not going to counter better than Dark Knight, but I'm not going to be like, you try something easy.
See, and that's an apt metaphor for the difference between you and me, is because for you, these movies stick the landing, mm-hmm. and for me, they don't.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Yes.
And in relation to like how bad these movies can be...
be horrible.
Yeah. I'm just...
They can't be something that bad.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, they could easily go into the backup plan, which is just shit.
I have barely scratched the surface, by the way, of the worst of 2011.
Sorry.
Because we've still got Priest, Pirates 4, Hangover 2, Judy Moody... And the No Bummer Summer.
Yeah, that's a movie.
The Art of Getting By. Green Lantern. Something Borrowed, we now added. Mr. Popper's Penguins.
Oh.
Cars 2. Larry Crown, which is one of the most offensively white movies ever made, Transformers 3, Zookeeper.
Transformers 3 wasn't that bad.
Yes, it was. Zookeeper, The Smurfs, The Change-Up, Conan. Oh, Conan. Spy Kids 4, and Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
Change-Up wasn't that bad.
Conan, come on.
Conan's terrible.
I thought you liked it. I thought you were at that screening. I thought you liked it.
I didn't. No. No, I did not. I was Conan, not one of the people
Conan's
that liked
not
it.
Terrible. All right,
I will take it off just because Jason Momoa might break my spine if I don't. So, okay. So this is, as Elliot mentioned, I think the first summer that really gives 2008 a run for its money. So Fast Five, Thor, X-Men First Class, Captain America the First Avenger, the last Harry Potter movie, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Attack the Block, Fright Night.
I think it takes it.
Let's reread
2008. Reread the positive, the good.
We're going to go good for good here. We're going to go, okay, 2008, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Iron Man, Kung Fu Panda, The Incredible Hulk, Wall-E, Hancock, Hellboy 2.
You can't count Hancock in that list.
Why not?
That is one of the good movies. That was, at best, mediocre. Like, it's uneven for most of it. And
do you guys feel that way, too?
I'm not a big fan of Hancock.
Adam?
A big fan of it? I think it still belongs on the positive side.
No, okay.
But, it was kind of an event movie, so yeah. It's
no, it's gone. All right, so Hellboy 2, The Dark Knight, Pineapple Express, Tropic Thunder, all of those up against Insidious, The King's Speech, Fast Five, Thor, Kung Fu Panda 2, so I guess they cancel each other out.
Not really, I think the Kung Fu Panda 1 is better.
First one's better,
okay. Yeah. Well, there you go. X-Men First Class, The Deathly Hallows Part 2, Captain America First Avenger, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Fright Night, Attack the Block.
Man.
It's tough because The Dark Knight is so goddamn good. Like,
well,
honestly,
the Dark Knight, Iron Man, and Wall-E together, like, that's a hell of a summer.
That's Ron, Kyrie, and Kevin Love right there.
But when you put the body of work together against that body of work, I feel like 2011 comes out with it.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, is that there are movies. I think Captain America First Avenger is on the same level for me as Iron Man. Attack the Block. Like, movies that I revisit and love with that much passion, I think Dark Knight and Attack the Block kind of cancel each other out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that still leaves Rise of the Planet of the Apes, X-Men First Class, Fast Five, Thor, The King's Speech was one of the
best. If you're looking at it that way and stuff,
yeah,
just canceling each other out, then yeah.
In terms of pure quantity, like the number of really good movies, I don't think any of them are greater than The Dark Knight or Wall-E.
Mm-hmm.
But I think
the sheer volume
of it.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
I think that makes it a better summer.
The goddamn Spurs versus the Miami Heat.
Well, of course you got to look at X-Men First Class and Rise, like, relaunched franchises.
Actually, JC, that is a really apt metaphor, because the reason 2011 is beating 2008, even though 2008 has its big three, is that 2011 has a deeper bench. This is literally the Spurs versus the Heat.
Yeah, whatever. Let's move on.
All right, fine. 2012 for the best here.
I'm not bitter, by the way.
No, not at all. And I know one of these movies you guys are going to argue with me on, and that's fine. I will
for
take
the worst?
It out for the best.
Oh, okay.
Because I still think it's one of the best of the summer. Anyway.
Is it Killer Joe?
No.
Oh.
Wait, Killer.
It came up when I Wikipedia'd it.
Really?
Yeah. We saw it South by, so yeah. It's probably right. Summer.
Hold on, I have to add something.
What is
Killer Joe?
What's Killer Joe?
Matthew McConaughey in the William Friedkin movie where he's a hitman. It was one of the first movies of the McConaissance.
Oh, I have to see it. I haven't seen it.
It's great. Okay, so for the best, we have Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah.
Pirates, Band of Misfits.
Oh, I know what you're going to...
The Avengers, Magic Mike, Ted, The Dark Knight Rises. Yeah, I put it on there. Searching for Sugar Man, which was released limited that summer.
Mm-hmm.
Paranorman, Lawless, and Killer Joe.
Oh, I thought you were going to put Prometheus on there.
No.
I haven't seen Lawless.
Lawless is really good.
Any like, seriously, I'm willing to cede the floor to contentions here.
No, that was pretty solid.
Say one more time.
Cabin in the Woods, Pirates, Band of Misfits, which was by the same guys who did Chicken Run.
Right.
The Avengers, Magic Mike, Ted, The Dark Knight Rises, Searching for Sugar Man, Paranorman, Lawless, Killer Joe.
Did you think we were going to argue Ted?
No, I thought you were going to argue Dark Knight Rises.
I'm going to argue Pirates, Band of Misfits.
Did you see that movie?
I watched it at your recommendation because it was on the other station. And I was like, watching it, and maybe my expectations were too high because I watched it and I'm like, this is sort of boring.
I wouldn't judge it. I'm not a fan of the animation style, so I'm not a good person to like judge that movie. I know that people love it. So yeah,
Beef Nuggets?
I think the jokes are hilarious.
Okay.
So,
I mean, right. Ham Party is funny. I will give you that.
Ham Party is funny. Yeah. All right, and then for the worst, here we go. I'm going to take off one of these because it's not really fair for that summer. All right. American Reunion, Lockout, The Three Stooges, Think Like a Man, The Raven, Dark Shadows, Battleship, The Dictator, What to Expect When You're Expecting, which is the second most offensively white movie on the list.
That was a horrible fucking movie.
Yes, it was. Chernobyl Diaries, Prometheus I put on the worst just because of how it ended and how much just, like, anger it filled all of us with.
Huh.
Madagascar 3, Rock of Ages, That's My Boy.
Rock of Ages?
Burning.
Oh, yeah.
Rock of Ages is not even a movie.
That was fun...
It's an hour and a half of karaoke by celebrities. It's not a movie.
It's a good Tom Cruise performance.
By somebody who's not Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
No, by Tom Cruise.
No, I thought you were talking about the main guy who sort of does a Tom Cruise.
No, it's not. If it was a real movie with a real plot and not just celebrities doing karaoke for an hour and a half, I might have not put it on this list. But it was painful to sit through.
Hey, like the majority has beaten me. I see the floor.
That's My Boy can burn in hell. Abe Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. Which, I'm sorry, how do you make that movie boring? How do you make a movie where Abraham Lincoln is killing vampires boring?
Because it's a movie that sounds better in concept than execution.
Yes, absolutely. Madea Witness Protection, Savages, Ice Age Continental Drift, Diary of a Wimpy Kid Dog Days, Total Recall, The Bourne Legacy, The Campaign, The Expendables 2, The Apparition, Oogie Loves, and The Possession.
I think take Bourne Legacy off.
And I would take Savages off.
Ooh, Savages is not good.
Savages is real, real bad.
Savages is not good, but it's not the worst.
What do you think, Adam?
What, for Savages?
Yeah.
I didn't see it. But I'm not an Oliver Stone fan, so...
It's definitely stupid and heavy-handed.
Well, no, because, I mean, he brings up the point that Oliver Stone directed it, and I think it's easily one of the worst, like, I'd leave it in the worst.
There are parts that don't make me throw up.
Therefore, Elliot's seal of approval.
No, I mean, like, I think it's sort of harmless. Like, for something to be the worst, it has to be like, oh my god, I want to kill whoever made this.
So, here's the thing. I think 2012 was a really excellent summer for movies, because we did have Cabin in the Woods, we did have The Avengers, which was so, so good. But then we had surprise hits like Magic Mike and Ted, and then, of course, Searching for Sugar Man, which is a movie that even people who don't like documentaries got into. And then Paranorman was just such a breath of fresh air in the animation department. Just such a... And I kind of feel that same way about Pirates, Band of Misfits, too. So,
I'm going to let 2012 be the first year where the bad outweighs the good.
Yeah.
Mostly because of That's My Boy and Piranha 3DD.
That's... You know what?
That was a sh...
Oh! Yep, that's a fair point, too. So, in that sense, we are firmly saying that 2012 does not beat 2011.
Yeah. Avengers and Cabin in the Woods and Magic Mike, I love you, but... God, That's My Boy.
But here's a second question, follow-up question. 2012 or
2008? 2012.
2012 has Avengers, which
is the fruition of Iron Man.
Is the fruition of Iron Man, so I think cancels that. It doesn't cancel it out, it exceeds it.
And then you got Cabin in the Woods, something that totally deconstructs the horror genre, but makes it a comedy for part of it, too.
Mm-hmm. So, 2012 or 2008? What are we thinking?
I still think 2008.
All right, Elliot.
2012, just for the quality of the good movies was so much higher.
All right, JC.
I'll say 8.
2008.
And I think this is a little bit harder too, because 2012 is still only 2 years away.
That's
so
true.
Mm-hmm. Like, I haven't distanced myself enough from 2012 in order to deter. Like, the only one out of that pack that I know for sure is going to go down as a definitive movie of the decade is something like The Avengers, but. You know, but with in 2008, I mean, Iron Man, The Dark Knight, and WALL-E have all, I think, literally solidified themselves as, like, the premier, part of the premier movies of their genre.
I wouldn't say WALL-E.
Well, but for that reason, and for what JC said about there just being an overwhelming tidal wave of awful that summer, in addition to the good, I think 2008 still retains the number two spot. But I think 2012 is firmly in number three.
I take your arguments, and they make a lot of sense.
All right, so this brings us to 2013, which I gotta say this. This was a summer that was typified by a lot of average movies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even some of the biggest movies that year were just average. I will say maybe not even average is the right word, but extremely divisive. Mm-hmm. Like, they couldn't fall on one side or the other with most people.
Right.
So, for example, like Man of Steel, Pacific Rim, The Wolverine, Elysium, these were the biggest movies of the summer, and yet, you know, I know, Elliot, that you love
Pacific Rim. I am not going to hold that, that's
but,
my thing.
But you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Those were really divisive movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
They weren't huge hits, and they weren't epic flops.
No, they weren't. And the thing is, I fully understand that sometimes a movie hits you a certain way.
Yeah.
And it is...
With a rocket fist.
Yeah, and it's not an indicator of its overall quality.
Yeah.
Just for me, that's like my movie.
Yeah. See, this is what I thought was really interesting about the summer, is even the biggest tentpole movies of that summer were met with very mixed... Yeah. Reaction.
Yeah.
Man of Steel being one of them, Pacific Rim, The Wolverine, and Elysium. So I didn't even put them in the best or the worst, mm-hmm. and they were the biggest movies of that year. Huh. You know what I mean? Or like, do you think any of those four should be in one category or the other?
The Wolverine and Pacific Rim?
Well, I would even say Pacific Rim.
Yeah?
But no, the other three, those would definitely fall in the meh category for me.
What do you think, JC?
I mean, even though I was kind of mad on Pacific Rim, like, for my best, like, I put the Wolverine and Pacific Rim and Man of Steel in there. Me, personally, I love Man of Steel. Kind of mad on Pacific Rim. I like the Wolverine a lot. But, yeah, I mean, I do agree with you. I think that...
I think we're demonstrating the issue.
No, you are right demonstrating now. The issue. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, there's so many people that can go one way or the other.
So, I tell you what, let's set them aside for now, and if we need a tiebreaker, we'll bring them back into the conversation.
Yeah, because there are definites in there, like The World's End, and, yeah.
So, here's what I've got for the best of 2013. The Evil Dead remake, which was surprisingly good.
Yeah.
Pain and Gain, again, surprisingly good. Iron Man 3, This is the End, The Heat, The Conjuring, The World's End, and You're Next.
Yeah. Strong.
I think it's a pretty strong showing.
Except
for
You're Next for me.
Well, yeah. I think You're Next is fucking brilliant. I really do.
And that's the thing, that movie didn't hit me the right way.
Yeah.
With an axe.
Well, the problem with that movie was I that's when I really became friends with y'all that year.
Yeah.
And I was hearing so much hype that by the time I saw it, I thought it was going to be another Cabin in the Woods.
We were all kind of flavor for that movie. Yeah. We're all hype men on that.
And I'm not, yeah.
You know, last year was pretty much the year of, like, complete ambivalence to me. Like, I could be perfectly fine without any of those movies.
This is the End?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Iron Man 3, really?
No, yeah. Don't get me wrong. It's not like I don't really like some of those movies, but I just really like them. That's
and it's like to kind of put a emphasis on that point. Like on my list of the best, I put We're the Millers.
It was harmless,
and I would have put World War Z.
I didn't see World War Z.
The best thing about World War Z was the South Park parody they did with George Zimmerman. And Cartman, but like, get rampaging black people all over the place.
Now, here's another interesting thing about the summer of 2013, and you guys feel free to disagree, but there were far less shit movies this year than most of the other years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the worst I have for that year is Scary Movie 5, and again, even some of these I think are going to be points of contention, but mine are Scary Movie 5, The Great Gatsby, Tyler Perry's Peebles, After Earth, The Internship, The Lone Ranger, Grown Ups 2, RIPD, Turbo, Smurfs 2, Jobs, Paranoia, Mortal Instruments, Getaway, and the One Direction movie.
I put the Bling Ring in there as the worst.
Oh, I didn't like the Bling Ring. I actually thought it was a pretentious piece of garbage.
But
Emma Watson sort of saves that movie.
But I don't know. I feel like it's just a movie that, I don't know. Anyway.
And I feel Internship...
I was going to say, that's a whole lot of, like, fours and sevens.
Exactly. Like, even the shit movies that year aren't... I mean, with a couple of exceptions, aren't the shittiest movies.
Yeah, it's like Internship is just a movie that should have been released in 2005.
Exactly, when Google was actually like a new thing for people. But yeah, I think you're right, Adam. I think even the worst movies, some of them would get, you know, fours, fives, six, maybe even six ratings.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Interesting thing about that year, though, is I every year at the end I do a bottom five. And my least favorite two movies from that year were both Ryan Reynolds movies in Turbo and RIPD.
That means you get a new agent.
Yeah, he really does. So, okay, so that's 2013. I think it is interesting. I think it's interesting that some of the biggest movies that year, again, were just kind of average. But, you know, where you can just talk on the basis of fan reaction are very average. And there is a far fewer number of shit movies, and then even within the shittiest movies, you could argue that a lot of them are just average. It was I think, Adam, you've hit the nail on the head with it's the year of complete ambivalence. Like, even the worst movies don't have the stones to be terrible. It's all just a very average year, and I think there are a few standouts.
There are some standouts. Like, I will remember Pacific Rim and This is the End for the rest of my life.
I love This is the End. I love The World's End. I loved You're Next. The Conjuring is absolutely fantastic. And I really did love Iron Man 3.
Iron Man 3 is fucking awesome.
Yeah. So, we'll come back to 2013, and that brings us, of course, to this summer, which here's my list of the best. There may be a couple you guys want me to remove. Captain America: The Winter Soldier, Oculus, The Raid 2, Godzilla, X-Men: Days of Future Past, Chef, Edge of Tomorrow, 22 Jump Street, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and Guardians of the Galaxy.
How to Train Dragon 2.
How to Train Your Dragon 2. Oh,
really? Yeah, that counts.
Yeah.
I would remove Oculus.
I put Snowpiercer on there.
Snowpiercer. That's right. These limited release movies they fly under my radar, but Snowpiercer was amazing, and I will take off Oculus because that was the one I knew was most a personal thing and not being as objective as I could be.
I love Karen Gilliam, but
yeah.
And even though it wasn't, I don't think I was as taken with it as a lot of people were, especially in the critical community. But I would put Boyhood on there too.
Limited releases. All right, so that's a decently strong summer, and then. I had a hard time finding, and maybe it's just because I didn't see enough of the bad movies this year, but, I had a hard time coming up with a long list of the worst movies. I got Rio 2, Haunted House 2, Transcendence, Brick Mansions, The Quiet Ones, Blended, Think Like a Man 2, Transformers, 4 being in the middle, Earth to Echo, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and Into the Storm.
I haven't seen the last two, so I can't.
Jersey check. Boys.
Oh yeah, wait, no, you're right. Jersey Boys is on the list too.
It was direct to video, but Walk of Shame.
Direct to video.
Limited release. It was like 5 screens.
Yeah.
If it's that limited, yeah, I know.
Tammy, did you put Tammy?
I did not. Was it bad?
Was it
bad enough to be among the worst?
Oh yeah, I think.
Okay.
So. Let's ask this: did Ashley like it? Because Ashley likes Melissa McCarthy, but if she didn't like it, it must be.
Oh, shame. I don't even know if Ashley liked it. I should probably pay attention to my website. ESPN.
She actually did kind of. I'm remembering the review. She was softer on it than the rest of us were.
Well, then she. There's a difference between
being softer on it than everybody else and actually giving it a glowing, review.
Yeah, because she liked that Identity Thief movie.
Yeah, that was really bad. Hmm. All right, so here's the question, guys. How does 2014 stack up against 2013?
I think it beats it handily.
Yeah. Against 2013, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So now, how does 2014 stack up against 2012?
Okay, remember 2012 again?
Cabin in the Woods, Pirates, Band of Misfits, The Avengers, Magic Mike, Ted, The Dark Knight Rises, Searching for Sugar Man, Paranorman, Lawless, Killer Joe, versus Captain America, Winter Soldier, The Raid 2, Godzilla, X-Men, Days of Future Past, Chef, Edge of Tomorrow, 22 Jump Street, Dawn. Yeah, I don't even think that's a question.
I think, 2014.
There's so much good in 2014 that... Yeah. All right, I think it takes the third spot away from 2014. That's interesting. All right, so I think 2012 trumps 2013 by a sizable margin.
Yeah. So is it 2012 versus 2014?
It's 2012 versus 2010, which is Kick-Ass 18, Toy Story. I still think it beats. Inception, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, those are great movies, but 2012 with Cabin and The Avengers and Magic Mike and, for me it's still 2012 over 2010.
I agree.
All right. Okay. So, let's see, 2010 versus 2013. I think 2013 is going to end up being...
Probably fourth.
Right in the middle.
It's going to be right in the middle.
Right in the middle.
With you. All right, so what about 2010 versus 2009? So that's Kick-Ass, A-Team, Toy Story 3, Despicable Me, Inception, Scott Pilgrim, Last Exorcism versus Star Trek, Up, The Hangover, 500 Days of Summer, District 9, and Inglourious Basterds.
9.
I would say 9.
Oh, I'd say 10.
Ooh. I'm going to go
with... Read it again.
Okay.
Read it again. One more time.
Star Trek, Up, The Hangover, 500 Days of Summer, District 9, and Glorious Bastards. That's 2009. Okay. Versus Kick-Ass, The A-Team, Toy Story 3, Despicable Me, Inception, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, and The Last Exorcism.
No, you're right. 09. 09. Now that I hear it again, it's 09.
I think 09.
All right. Which...
I was giving too much weight to Scott Pilgrim because I love that movie.
When it comes to 2010, I'm just like, man, I really fucking love Scott Pilgrim.
So, 2013 versus 2010. So, Kick-Ass 18, Toy Story 3, Despicable Me, Inception, Scott Pilgrim, versus The Year of Ambivalence.
Yeah.
I put 2013.
Yeah. What, 2013? Really?
I put 2013.
For that, I put 10, because, Scott Pilgrim, like I said, I like Kick-Ass a lot. What were the other 2010?
18, Inception, Toy Story 3, Inception.
18 was just okay. Yeah.
I think the potency of the movies that I really like in 2010 outweigh the outweighs the overwhelming average of 2013.
Yeah. Well, see, but for me, the movies I'll remember, if I put them up against each other, I think that was Scott Pilgrim was in the other one, and then you got Pacific Rim, This Is the End, I will remember those two for the rest of my life.
Well, what's funny is the way we've done this, 2013 actually finished last of this group.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. So our rankings for the summers of the last, since 2008, number one is 2011, which featured Insidious, The King's Speech, Fast Five, Thor, Kung Fu Panda 2, X-Men First Class, Deathly Hallows Part 2, Captain America First Avenger, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Fright Night, Attack the Block. At number two, we have 2008, which had Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Iron Man, Kung Fu Panda, The Incredible Hulk, Wall-E, Hellboy 2, The Dark Knight, Pineapple Express, and Tropic Thunder. Coming in at number three is 2014, this year, Captain America, Winter Soldier, The Raid 2, Godzilla, X-Men, Days of Future Past, Chef, Edge of Tomorrow, 22 Jump Street, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Guardians of the Galaxy, How to Train Your Dragon 2, Snowpiercer, and Boyhood.
2014 should be higher.
I don't think we've done 2014 versus
the 2 years. We haven't done 2014 versus...
Oh.
That's what I was wondering.
Versus, okay, so...
We haven't done 2014 versus 08 or 2012.
Yeah, okay. We haven't done 14 versus 8.
All right. Yeah. So, 14 versus 8. Again, is Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Iron Man.
Okay, Incredible. I give it 2014.
Really?
I really do. Like, there's been so many... The quality and the lasting impact, I feel like, is more for 2014.
And I think there's a lot of interesting things starting off this year. Like, even though Guardians is, like, way into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I think it's still kind of starting something new. You got Godzilla starting something new. There's something else I was thinking of that kind of was a unique... Edge of Tomorrow was, like, a unique and fresh take on...
Adam, do you agree? 2014 over 2008?
I agree.
All right. Well, yeah. Then that settles it. So, at number three now is 2008, which is Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Iron Man, Kung Fu Panda, The Incredible Hulk, Wall-E, Hellboy 2, The Dark Knight, Pineapple Express, Tropic Thunder... And at number two is this summer.
We gotta do them.
Wait, what did I do? Was I doing it the other way?
We gotta do them. We gotta do
number 14 versus what's number one now?
2011. So, wow, I thought we'd done all this, but you guys are right. So that means that we now have 2011 as our number one, but it needs to go up against this summer. So does this summer's crop beat Insidious, The King's Speech, Fast Five, Thor, Kung Fu Panda 2, X-Men First Class, Deathly Hallows Part 2, Captain America, First Avenger, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Fright Night, and Attack the Block?
Oh.
And again,
that's interesting.
This lineup is Winter Soldier, Raid 2, Godzilla, X-Men Days of Future Past, Chef, Edge of Tomorrow, 22 Jump Street, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Guardians of the Galaxy, How to Train Your Dragon 2, Snowpiercer, and Boyhood.
I would say...
I feel like we got a John Nash that's on your window.
Well, hey, look, what I would say is that it would beat it if 2014 didn't owe almost all of the success of 2011. Because 2014, in my mind, is just taking what 2011 did and expanding on it.
Yeah, I mean, Elliot is exactly right. I mean, like, you have Captain America First Avenger in 2011, Winter Soldier in 2014. That's an interesting point.
I would give
and then X-Men Days of Future Past in 2014, we have First Class in 2011.
And then you had another one that did that, too. I forgot which one it was, though.
Yep, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes versus Rise. You're absolutely right, Elliot. That's a fair point.
I would give 14 the edge, though, just because of kind of like I said earlier, this is the year that we're kind of starting to recognize that Hollywood is giving unique and fresh voices a chance. Yeah. And so, like, even though Chris Miller and Philip Lord have had movies before, this is the first year where we're kind of like, holy shit, Lord and Miller. And we're anxious to see what they're going to do next with the Lego Movie and 22 Jump Street, Godzilla, Edge of Tomorrow, I think. I would give the edge to this summer.
Well, hold on.
Okay.
Because I would make that argument for James Wan and Insidious in 2011, and Rupert Wyatt for Rise of the Planet of the Apes in 2011.
Sure.
Because I'm saying, like, Joe Cornish
attacked the block, 2011. Yeah. If that's the argument, I feel like you've got even more examples.
Shit, that's true.
And yeah. Kenneth Branagh getting a superhero movie in 2011. Yeah. So, not that Kenneth Branagh was a talent anybody was doubting, but to be given the keys to a superhero franchise when he had done Shakespeare up to that point.
Man, I kind of want to do one in 1A.
The one movie I would say puts 2014 over, if we were going to go that way, would be Guardians of the Galaxy, because what Guardians of the Galaxy does, it proves that Marvel does not have to only make superhero movies.
I think we got to put this to a vote. So let's just go around the room. Elliot, 2011 or 2014?
Come back to me.
Adam, 2011, 2014.
I'm going to say 2014.
All right, I got one for 2014. JC?
Yeah, I'm going to say 14.
14. I'm going to go with 11.
We're at 11.
Shit, so we've got a split vote.
You know what? Okay, so I think we're splitting on the positives.
You're right.
Of the two?
Okay, yeah.
Let's go over the negatives.
Yeah,
it is entirely true that 2011 has more shit than this summer did. That being said,
but how stinky is the shit?
That being said,
this summer had Transformers 4.
That
so
that being said, I saw a lot more of the shit in 2011 than I did this year too. So there may be stuff that just didn't make my list because I didn't see it.
The shit.
All right, so the worst in 2011, like the worst of the worst. I'm going to go through like the real shit stuff. Would be like Arthur, Dylan Dog, Priest, Green Lantern.
Ugh.
Mr. Popper's Penguins, Something Borrowed,
yeah.
Zookeeper, Spy Kids 4. So, like, eight just, like, of the... That's the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
Now, in 2014, I think the worst of the worst is, like, Haunted House 2, Transformers, Think Like a Man 2, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Yeah. I'd say those are, like, the worst of the worst.
Well, those criteria, you gotta give it to 2011, then. I mean, the 2014, sorry.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's enough for me to swing my vote.
11 was really bad.
So 2014 is...
2014 is our champion, guys.
We are living in the golden age.
We are. 2011 finishes at number 2. So here's
it's all downhill from here.
So at number 7, we have last summer, 2013. And then at number 6 was 2010. Number 5, 2009. Number 4, 2012. Number 3 was 2008, which is, I'm really surprised that it finished 3rd. Number 2 would be 2011, and number 1, this very summer. Thank you, James Gunn. I think you've shifted the bell curve considerably. But that is our power rankings of the summer movie seasons. We're going to finish off the show with the dregs, the sidekicks, the leftovers. It's time for And the Rest.
And the rest are here on Gilligan's Island.
And not only that, but we're going to make this a lightning round!
I'm not overly fond of what follows.
First, we're going to start by self-reporting a little nonsense. That's right, we're talking NCAA compliance now. The University of South Carolina has been self-reporting a number of violations over the last year, and recently they started rolling out their own And the Rest. And in other words, the secondary, less-than-major violations. And we want you to brace yourselves, however, for the sheer audacity and the utter despicableness of this particular self-reported violation that reads, and I quote, "One infraction from last winter involved impermissible ice decorations on a cookie cake given to prospects." I'm going to repeat that for full effect. "One infraction from last winter involved impermissible iced decorations on a cookie cake given to prospects."
Wait, so this infraction was literally the icing on the cake?
Yes, it was! Thank you, Adam!
Nice! I was going for this is the Mrs. Fields Award of Absurdity, but
well, here's what's great about this. It's not that the prospective athlete received a cookie cake, because as silly as that would be, it would be understandable because it is a gift. The infraction specifically about the impermissible ice decorations on the cookie cake.
It's like a naked woman that was drawn or something.
Is there like a threshold of icing that can be on the cookie cake?
Did they stick like $100 bills in the icing?
It's hard to say. It's like how much icing is allowed on a cookie cake
for
prospects before it becomes a violation.
It's fucking sugar and milk.
I want to start a segment on this show where we basically open up our own version of the NCAA rulebook and like almost like Barney Stinson and just start reading off the rules for being a sports nerd. Like, what thou shall not do. But I tell you what I did is I actually tweeted to our friends at the OU compliance office and I asked them this question and I tried to make it clear to them that I was being entirely serious. I said, if a prospect receives a cookie cake, what would be the acceptable amount of icing on that cake before it would be a violation? And as of right now, they have not responded. But I will keep watching that. So thank you, University of South Carolina, for proving once again that the NCAA's list of violations is draconian and absurd at the same time.
This is like a really weird award system.
Yes.
Like, you did really well in high school, so what the fuck? You want a cookie? No, I want a cookie with icing. Well, you can't have that.
Well, you can't have it.
I want a cookie cake with icing, thank you.
And next up, we got fighters getting into fights, yo! Yeah, I know. That's about as earth-shattering as being told the latest Freeberg and Seltzer movie is about as funny as rectal cancer. But still, it's always enjoyable when guys who are literally paid millions of dollars to beat each other up in the ring can't wait until they're in the ring to apply their pugilist trade. So we have two fights. We've kind of discussed one already on our MMA segment, which is basically mean mugging goes wrong. But the other one, I gotta say, and the mean mugging goes wrong was John Jones versus Daniel Cormier. But the one that I... Okay, there's one that's... how to put this? It's just as fabricated as Tom Cruise's marriage to Katie Holmes. the totally real, quote-unquote, confrontation by Shannon Briggs of the current boxing champion Vladimir Klitschko, who we've once again been assured is not a villain from the original Red Dawn. Klitschko in this video is having a nice Italian meal when all of a sudden Briggs storms in and goes completely Clubber Lang on him. She's like, what you want, champ? Why won't you fight me, champ? Everywhere you go, I go, champ. I'm going to eat what you eat, champ. And that really becomes like the last straw as he reaches across the table and takes Klitschko's dinner and just starts eating it. He's like, I'm going to eat what you eat. And then so Klitschko, who's obviously a holder of the maxim that you never touch another man's penne, proceeds to pour water on Briggs' head.
Very, very calmly, like, just like,
almost like he's baptizing him. And Briggs, like, sends the place settings flying, and then a cadre of carelessly obese interlopers jump in between them.
Yeah, and why are you jumping in the middle of that?
And forcing them outside. Now, okay, I don't buy it. I don't buy this for one second. Where did these giant dudes come from? One. And secondly, the guy who's filming it knows exactly when to start filming. Like, there's not, like, he's already at the table and the guy's, like, had to take his, oh, shit, stuff's going down. Yeah. He has his phone out, like, as the guy's coming in before he says anything. Yeah. He does everything but cue him.
Well, to your one, they came from Hardee's. That's number one. And two, I agree with you, is probably fake.
Well, it's like when Mia Jovovich walks up to the camera in The Fourth Kind and looks at the audience and asserts, oh, no, for super serious guys, this is totally not a made-up story.
I'm total super serial right now.
I'm so super serial right now. No one will take me serial.
Oh. I just thought it was weird that the camera was on a tripod. It's like, how did he know?
And again,
it was pretty stable.
What was he filming before that guy walked in there that he needed a tripod?
And look at him eat that spaghetti.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is I'm not buying this Klitschko Jovovich movie, so just going to move on from that. Next up, Marcin Gortat is now possibly my favorite NBA player of all time. And by the way, Marcin Gortat is not actually an anagram of Groot Racing, which remains a sport I would pay to see, pay all the money to see.
Groot.
So he was given some unusual props on Twitter regarding his recent contract extension. So, Elliot, why don't you fill us in on this?
Basically, he was up late at night one night, and the guy tweeted at him, you got that contract extension, you can afford that pay point, you don't have to go to export anymore.
Yeah, he said...
Specifically, you can afford that Brazzers membership, because the guy who tweeted at him can only rely on X videos.
And then Marcin Gortat, in the words of Mike Birbiglia, what he should have said was nothing. What he did say was, I don't have one yet. Is it good? ?
Yeah.
So now it becomes a conversation about the quality of various porn providers between some random douchebag and a professional basketball player.
It's not so much that as do you want to pay for your entertainment? Like, the people who subscribe to one of us, they pay for their entertainment.
Please do not embarrass Elliot, I love it when you do random plugs for the website. I really do. But the day you start comparing us to Brazzers is the day I don't want you to do that anymore.
Clearly, he thinks it is worth it because the guy told him, he's like, I've never had a membership, but I guess it's worth it because they're all in high definition. To which Marcin Gortat said, oh, yeah, that's a big plus.
Okay, I'm going to stop you. I'm going to stop you right there. It's not a big plus at all. I'm going to, like... I've seen my fair share of porn, probably a lot of other guys' fair share as well. I've had a lot of people's fair share. You don't want high definition. You don't want all the imperfections of that part of the body to be up close and personal.
Well,
There's
a really, there's a porn star named Asak here who has a hilarious Twitter, and she put on the other day, like, who really came up with the idea of HD porn anyway? Who thought that was a good idea?
No. DP porn is fine, HD porn is not.
And I wonder how much he does respond to his fans, because there was another one. This tweet is just weird, because it's from a dude. He says, I see you, big boy. Just keep that Polish hammer all wrapped up and safe now.
What?
To which, because, you know, Marcin Gortat's Polish.
I got that part.
He's talking about his Polish sausage.
Yeah. To which he responded, ha ha ha, my man, you crazy. I will.
Yeah,
and sometimes this is some R. Kelly. It's like somebody needs to get out of that closet.
I'm sorry, it's like a conversation on OkCupid, like that we're watching on Twitter. It's pretty incredible. So, Marcin Gortat, you are possibly my new favorite person in the NBA.
You know, thinking about it, I was joking, but responding
and the
beef on a porn,
is following him now.
Responding on a porn Twitter, maybe he's in the closet and he wants to seem like he's really, really straight.
I don't know. It's hard to say. It's hard for us to speculate on that without getting the pants off of us.
I'm speculating.
So,
I don't know.
For some more interesting facts about Marcin Gortat, he has a pet potbelly pig.
Oh!
He's a weird dude, and I kind of want to hang out with him. Is that weird? I want to hang out with this guy.
Okay.
Wrapping up the show with a story that I think is much in keeping with the spirit of Inside the Locker, the worlds of professional football and anime have finally started to merge.
Yes.
Yes, after so much waiting, we've finally reached the point where those two spheres have overlapped, because apparently recently the Tennessee Titans and AkaiCon?
Yeah, AkaiCon.
AkaiCon had to share the same hotel. So all of the players of the Tennessee Titans are probably walking around their floor, and here comes Yu-Gi-Oh, and here comes somebody dressed as a character from Bleach, and here comes someone who's from Ghost in the Shell, and they're probably just like, what the fuck is going on here?
No, it reminds me of this last week I was in San Antonio at a hotel for a conference, and I have a membership at Crunchyroll, and I was watching anime in the lobby because they had free Wi-Fi, and it's like full screen on my laptop, and like, you got a bunch of lawyers walking by me, and I'm like, move along. I enjoy anime, and you can just miss out.
This is going to be a premise for a horror movie next year, by the way.
Yeah, more than likely. Like, all these... You know, that'd actually be hilarious to turn the tables where all the jocks are terrified that the anime nerds are going to murder them because they're crazy.
Well, they need to be at BronyCon.
Oh, BronyCon.
Or ClopperCon.
Oh, don't... No, I'm sorry. That's too much.
That's not to be mentioned on this show.
That's a little too far. Well, that is going to do it for the show this week. I want to remind you yet again that you can like the website on Facebook, facebook.com/oneofusnet. You can also follow us on Twitter at ITLcast. You can follow us individually. I'm at Bryguy Salisbury.
At ITL Elliot.
At the underscore beef.
At JCDeLeon1.
And also Fest of Us coming up next week in the 15th through the 17th. Three straight days of activities and shenanigans just for the hell of it. Well, also in celebration of our one-year anniversary, which was technically last month. But that's fine. Don't worry about it.
And for the smell of it.
And just for the smell of it. And also, once again, if you guys have a few extra dimes laying around and you want to contribute to our GoFundMe that is built to support a fan of ours who's fallen on hard times, a guy named Eli, we'd really appreciate that. You can get the full story on Eli's situation by clicking on that GoFundMe link right at the bottom of the page. And like I said, we really do appreciate your generosity. But yeah, that's going to do it this week for JC, for Elliot, for Adam. This is Brian saying that Inside the Locker is at least as good as Brazzers.